Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The black female being hit. Every black female should leave here and say to every other black female that a part of the so-called black culture, which we're always talking about in settings like this, is going to be from now on that no black male, for any reason other than direct self-defense, meaning she kind of lost her head or something or whatever and came running out of the kitchen swinging her axe while you sitting there eating your Tostitos. See, now you have to take direct action to defend yourself. But I'm saying, because she gave you some lip, sounding off, or spent some money that she wasn't supposed to, or whatever, she's not supposed to be hit. See, I haven't earned the right to hit no black female. Haven't earned it. And when I get in position to earn it, then I'll have no reason to. See, so it doesn't work out any way that you shake it up and pour it. I'm not going to go around hitting the white supremacists, so why should I be busting her in the teeth? Talking about, I'm a man. See, we got these huge voices. See, the average black male got a deep voice like mine. Okay, a lot of us. And when we go to work on a female, one thing that we are proving is our what? Quote, manhood. And then after we get through knocking her all up and down the steps with all the little people, young people running around there saying, what's going on up there? See? And some of your own young ones running around saying, don't do that, Daddy. Don't. It's going on right this minute. It's going on right this minute. And then what happens? Somebody calls. Now, you're hitting her to prove that you are a man. Then somebody calls the man. Okay? Really, it ain't but one. Now we're going to find out what a boy is. And so here he comes, tracking mud right across your living room floor that you just got through telling her about cleaning up. That's why you hit her in the mouth. See? Now he comes in there walking, tracking mud. What's the trouble? What's the trouble with you, fella? See? Talking very calmly. And all of a sudden, you come down. We just have a little misunderstanding also. Why don't you hit him? And his buddy behind him. See? And kick them all out in the street and say, if you got any more down there like you, send them down here. See? Because I said I was a man, and I'm proving it. You think a man just goes around hitting women? You chumps going to find out what a man is tonight. See yourself doing that? And since you're not going to do that, think in advance. See, people who are what you call creative or forward thinking, they think in advance. So I'm saying you leave here tonight. See, everything that I'm saying is not supposed to be just within a jestful fashion, even though I'm making it that way, because it's kind of hard sitting and listening to somebody just jawbone all the time. I'm saying leave here. The female is not a bitch, not ever. When you slip up and say it, make out a catalog. That makes the fourth time I've said it this week. Try to cut that down to one. See? And just remember, same way with ML. and don't hit the female. Now, the females can cooperate with this and kind of push it along by, when everything is going fine, when you first meet this fella that you think you really like and you're going to start spending some time with him, and when you all are sitting somewhere with the candlelight and roses, if that's the setting, or wherever, in the apartment, in the car, and you're really talking about how much you really go for each other and all the rest of that stuff that you half believe, okay? The female should speak up and say, "Johnny, I want to tell you something that's very, 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 very important to me. And we've been seeing each other about a month now. Don't ever hit me." Now, if you hit me, there's nothing I can do because you're much bigger than me. You're muscular. You play basketball and all like this. But don't ever hit me, because what that will mean is that we can never be together again for any reason if you ever hit me. Now, I might say some things that might make you mad, or I might do some things that might make you mad. Hopefully not. But whatever happens, I want you to say that and get it in your mind that you will never hit me, because I can't stand for you to hit me. And it won't prove anything if you hit me. Now, some of the males sitting here will say, "Oh, man, some women like to be hit. How about that? See, the code got to cover everything." All right? Otherwise, it ain't code. What about a person, a black female, who likes to be hit? I mean, she's not satisfied until that at least two licks are hit, you know, come Saturday night. See, then everything kind of settles down after that. Been hit twice. That's about the quota for the night. And she's just that way. Now, you don't hit that person either, because you're supposed to have some sense. Because first place, first thing you're supposed to determine is that person does not need to be hit. That person needs help. See, anybody that needs to be hit needs help. Anybody who's asking to be hit, you know. Well, heck, this looks like Cecilia, you know, is always starting something where I hit her, or want to. So, you know, I'm going to take her, you know, somewhere to talk to somebody, find out why this is. That's if you're concerned enough. But the bottom line is, you should leave here tonight. See, I'm trying to give, we're always talking about what do we do about a situation. We start with these basic things. That keeps those blinking lights out of the neighborhood and all that breaking glass up there on the second floor. See? Dishes flying out the window and all that stuff that you got to pay for, by the way. See? Why break up the furniture? And then last but not least, out there, you know, "Man, take these cuffs, hey, loosen these cuffs up, they're too tight." See, it's going on right this minute, all stretched out across the hood. "Oh, settle down there, fella, settle down now." See, the voice of authority, the voice of people who know what they're doing, the voice of people who run every facet of your business, including when you hit what you call your woman. See? And we're just not going to have no more of this. Me and Pete been up here twice in this apartment building tonight. We don't want to have to come up here again. Why can't you people behave? Now, that sounds awful. Like talking to children, because that's who he's talking to. Not men. Let's face it. Now, I'm putting a lot of bite in here, but this is the way it is. It takes that.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, August 22nd. 2019, so I have been told. That was Neely Fuller Jr., author of the United Independent Compensatory Code System Concept. You can check out his books at producejustice.com. This is the Cows Book Club, our eighth and final session on Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear. I pointed out frequently during the text, he's talking bad about O.J. Simpson every other paragraph, slipped in his jab about Al Sharpton, In my view, he's talking about this white author is talking about white supremacy racism indirectly the entire time in this book, although he never mentions racism. I think that's a huge act of racism, and we've talked about that a lot over the past few weeks as we've read this text. However, I've said it before, I will reiterate on our last session. One of the main reasons we are reading this book is because the system of white supremacy encourages intense, extraordinary violence against black people from white people and other non-white people. All of us, one of the things that we can be about is not harming other non-white people and not standing as best we can in a weak position, not standing for other non-white people being harmed first time, last time. That is certainly something that we can encourage to try as best we can. It's not a whole lot that we can do as victims of white supremacy, but we can say, hey, I am not going to go around smacking on another female, smacking on another male, smacking on another child that is a victim of white supremacy. That is one thing that I can do, and that's one thing that I'm going to make clear first time, last time. First time, last time. One of the main reasons we are reading this book. Context of White Supremacy. This is Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear, audio segment number one.
Chapter 15. The Gift of Fear. Fears are educated into us and can, if we wish, be educated out. Carl A. Menninger. We all know there are plenty of reasons to fear people from time to time. The question is, what are those times? Far too many people are walking around in a constant state of vigilance, their intuition misinformed about what really poses danger. It needn't be so. When you honor accurate intuitive signals and evaluate them without denial, believing that either the favorable or the unfavorable outcome is possible, you need not be wary, for you will come to trust that you'll be notified if there is something worthy of your attention. Fear will gain credibility because it won't be applied wastefully. When you accept the survival signal as a welcome message and quickly evaluate the environment or situation, fear stops in an instant. Thus, trusting intuition is the exact opposite of living in fear. In fact, the role of fear in your life lessons, as your mind and body come to know that you will listen to the quiet wind chime and have no need for klaxons. Real fear is a signal intended to be very brief, a mere servant of intuition. But though few would argue that extended, unanswered fear is destructive, millions choose to stay there. They may have forgotten or never learned that fear is not an emotion like sadness or happiness, either of which might last a long while. It is not a state like anxiety. True fear is a survival signal that sounds only in the presence of danger. Yet, unwarranted fear has assumed a power over us that it holds over no other creature on earth. In The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker explains that animals, in order to survive, have had to be protected by fear responses. Some Darwinians believe that the early humans who were most afraid were most likely to survive. The result, says Becker, is the emergence of man as we know him, a hyper-anxious animal who constantly invents reasons for anxiety even when there are none. It need not be this way. I learned this again on a recent visit to Fiji, where there is less fear in the entire republic than there is at some intersections in Los Angeles. One morning, on a peaceful, hospitable island called Vanua Levu, I took a few-mile walk down the main road. It was lined on both sides with low ferns. Occasionally, over the sound of the quiet ocean to my left, I'd hear an approaching car or truck. Heading back toward the plantation where I was staying, I closed my eyes for a moment as I walked. Without thinking at first, I just kept them closed because I had an intuitive assurance that walking down the middle of this road with my eyes closed was a safe thing to do. When I analyzed this odd feeling, I found it to be accurate. The island has no dangerous animals and no assaultive crime. I would feel the ferns touch my legs if I angled to either side of the road, and I'd hear an approaching vehicle and plenty of time to simply open my eyes. To my surprise, before the next car came along, I had walked more than a mile with my eyes closed, trusting that my senses and intuition were quietly vigilant. When it comes to survival signals, our minds have already done their best work by the time we try to figure things out. In effect, we've reached the finish line and handily won the race before even hearing the starting pistol, if we just listen without debate. Admittedly, that blind walk was in Fiji, but what about in a big American city? Not long ago, I was in an elevator with an elderly woman who was heading down to an underground parking garage after business hours. Her keys were protruding through her fingers to form a weapon, which also displayed her fear. She was afraid of me when I got into the elevator, as she is likely afraid of all men she encounters when she is in that vulnerable situation. I understand her fear, and it saddens me that millions of people feel it so often. The problem, however, is that if one feels fear of all people all the time, there is no signal reserved for the times when it's really needed. A man who gets into the elevator on another floor and hence wasn't following her. A man who gives her no undue attention, who presses a button for a floor other than the one she has selected, who is dressed appropriately, who is calm, who stands a suitable distance from her, is not likely to hurt her without giving some signal. Fear of him is a waste, so don't create it. I strongly recommend caution and precaution. But many people believe, and we are even taught, that we must be extra alert to be safe. In fact, this usually decreases the likelihood of perceiving hazard and thus reduces safety. Alertly looking around while thinking, "Someone could jump out from behind that hedge. Maybe there's someone hiding in that car," replaces perception of what actually is happening with imaginings of what could happen. We are far more open to every signal when we don't focus on the expectation of specific signals. You might think a small animal that runs across a field in a darting crisscross fashion is fearful, even though there isn't any danger. In fact, scurrying is a strategy, a precaution, not a reaction to a fear signal. Precautions are constructive, whereas remaining in a state of fear is destructive. It can also lead to panic, and panic itself is usually more dangerous than the outcome we dread. Rock climbers and long-distance ocean swimmers will tell you it isn't the mountain or the water that kills. It is panic. Meg is a woman who works with violently inclined mental patients every day. She rarely feels fear at her job. But away from work, she tells me, she feels panic every night as she walks from her car to her apartment. When I offer the unusual suggestion that she'd actually be safer if she relaxed during that walk, she says, "That's ridiculous. If I relaxed, I'd probably get killed." She argues that she must be acutely alert to every possible risk. Possibilities, I explained, are in the mind, while safety is enhanced by perception of what is outside the mind, perception of what is happening, not what might happen. But Meg insists that her nightly fear will save her life, and even as she steadfastly defends the value of her terror, I know she wants to be free of it. DeBecker: "When do you feel the fear?" Meg: "As I park my car." "Is it the same every night?" "Yes. And then if I hear a noise or something, it gets 10 times worse, so I have to stay extra alert. Living in Los Angeles, I have to stay alert all the time." Note her reference to Los Angeles, a satellite. I explain that if she's scared to death every night, focused intently on what might happen, then no signal is reserved for when there actually is risk that needs her attention. Ideally, when there is fear, we look around, follow the fear, ask what we are perceiving. If we are looking for some specific expected danger, we are less likely to see the unexpected danger. I urge that she pay relaxed attention to her environment rather than paying rapt attention to her imagination. I know Meg is feeling anxious, and that is a signal of something, though not danger in this case. I ask her what risks she faces as she walks from her car each night. Isn't that a dumb question coming from you? I mean, there are so many risks. Los Angeles is a very dangerous city, not a place I choose to live.
But you do choose to live here.
No, I have to. I'm trapped by this job. I have to live here. And it's so dangerous. People are killed here all the time, and I know that. So I'm afraid when I walk to my apartment. Terrified, actually. And I should be.
Certainly anything could happen to anyone any time. But since you've made that walk more than 1,000 times without injury, the terror you feel is likely a signal of something other than danger. How do you normally communicate with yourself? An agitated Meg says she doesn't understand my question, but that she doesn't want to discuss it anymore. She'll think about it overnight. When she calls the following afternoon, she not only understands my question about how she communicates with herself, but has found her answer. She agrees that her intuition is indeed communicating something to her, and it isn't imminent danger. It is that she does not want to stay in Los Angeles or in her job. Her nightly walk from her car into her apartment is simply the venue for her inner voice to speak most loudly. Every day my work brings me into close contact with people who are afraid, anxious, or just worrying. My first duty is to figure out which it is. If it's real fear they feel, there is important information for me to glean, possibly relevant to safety. There are two rules about fear that, if you accept them, can improve your use of it, reduce its frequency, and literally transform your experience of life. That's a big claim, I know, but don't be afraid to consider it with an open mind. Rule number one, the very fact that you fear something is solid evidence that it is not happening. Fear summons powerful predictive resources that tell us what might come next. It's that which might come next that we fear, what might happen, not what is happening now. An absurdly literal example helps demonstrate this. If you stand near the edge of a high cliff, you might fear getting too close. If you stand right at the edge, you no longer fear getting too close, you now fear falling. Edward Gorey gives us his dark-humored but accurate take on the fact that if you do fall, you no longer fear falling, you fear landing. The suicide, as she is falling, illuminated by the moon, regrets her act and finds appalling the thought she will be dead so soon. Panic, the great enemy of survival, can be perceived as an unmanageable kaleidoscope of fears. It can be reduced through embracing the second rule. Rule number two, what you fear is rarely what you think you fear. It is what you link to fear. Take anything about which you have ever felt profound fear and link it to each of the possible outcomes. When it's real fear, it will either be in the presence of danger or it will link to pain or death. When we get a fear signal, our intuition has already made many connections. To best respond, bring the links into consciousness and follow them to their high-stakes destination, if they lead there. When we focus on one link only, say fear of someone walking toward us on a dark street, instead of fear of being harmed by someone walking toward us on a dark street, the fear is wasted. That's because many people will approach us. Only a very few might harm us. Surveys have shown that ranking very close to the fear of death is the fear of public speaking. Why would someone feel profound fear deep in his or her stomach about public speaking, which is so far from death? Because it isn't so far from death when we link it. Those who fear public speaking actually fear the loss of identity that attaches to performing badly. And that is firmly rooted in our survival needs. For all social animals, from ants to antelopes, identity is the pass card to inclusion, and inclusion is the key to survival. If a baby loses its identity as the child of its parents, a possible outcome is abandonment. For a human infant, that means death. As adults, without our identity as a member of the tribe or village, community or culture, a likely outcome is banishment and death. So the fear of getting up and addressing 500 people at the annual convention of professionals in your field is not just the fear of embarrassment. It's linked to the fear of being perceived as incompetent, which is linked to the fear of loss of employment, loss of home, loss of family, your ability to contribute to society, your value, in short, your identity, and your life. Linking an unwarranted fear to its ultimate terrible destination usually helps alleviate that fear. Though you may find that public speaking can link to death, you'll see that it would be a long and unlikely trip. Apply these two rules to the fear that a burglar might crash into your living room. First, the fear itself can actually be perceived as good news because it confirms that the dreaded outcome is not occurring right now. Since life has plenty of hazards that come upon us without warning, we could welcome fear with, "Thank you, God, for a signal I can act on." More often, however, we apply denial first, trying to see if perhaps we can just think it away. Remember, fear says something might happen. If it does happen, we stop fearing it and start to respond to it, manage it, surrender to it. Or we start to fear the next outcome we predict might be coming. If a burglar does crash into the living room, we no longer fear that possibility. We now fear what he might do next. Whatever that may be, while we fear it, it is not happening. Let's go one step deeper in this exploration of fear. In the 1960s, there was a study done that sought to determine which single word has the greatest psychological impact on people. Researchers tested reactions to words like spider, snake, death, rape, incest, murder. It was the word shark that elicited the greatest fear response. But why do sharks, which human beings come in contact with so rarely, frighten us so profoundly? The seeming randomness of their strike is part of it. So is the lack of warning, the fact that such a large creature can approach silently and separate body from soul so dispassionately. To the shark, we are without identity. We are no more than meat, and to human beings, the loss of identity is a type of death all by itself. In his book, Great White Shark, Jean-Michel Cousteau calls the shark the most frightening animal on earth. But there is, of course, an animal far more dangerous. Scientists marvel at the predatory competence of the great white, praising its speed, brute strength, sensory acuity, and apparent determination. But man is a predator of far more spectacular ability. The shark doesn't have dexterity, guile, deceit, cleverness, or disguise. It also doesn't have our brutality. For man does things to man that sharks couldn't dream of doing. Deep in ourselves, we know this, so occasional fear of another human being is natural. As with the shark attack, randomness and lack of warning are the attributes of human violence we fear most. But you know that human violence is rarely random and rarely without warning. Admittedly, danger from humans is more complicated than danger from sharks. After all, everything you need to know about how to be safe from sharks can be spoken in 5 words. Don't go in the ocean. Everything you need to know about how to be safe from people is in you too, enhanced by a lifetime of experience, and hopefully better organized by this book. We may choose to sit in the movie theater indulging in the fear of unlikely dangers now and again, but our fear of people, which can be a blessing, is often misplaced. Since we live every day with the most frightening animal on earth, understanding how fear works can dramatically improve our lives. People use the word fear rather loosely, but to put it in its proper relation to panic, worry, and anxiety, recall the overwhelming fear that possessed Kelly when she knew a rapist intended to kill her. Though people say of a frightening experience, "I was petrified," aside from those times when being still is a strategy, Real fear is not paralyzing. It is energizing. Rodney Fox learned this when he faced one of man's deepest fears. I was suddenly aware of moving through the water faster than I ever had before. Then I realized I was being pulled down by a shark which had hold of my chest. As the powerful predator took him from the surface, a far more powerful force compelled Rodney to caress the shark's head and face, searching for its eyes. He plunged his thumbs deep into the only soft tissue he found. The shark let go of him immediately, but Rodney embraced it and held on tight so it couldn't turn around for another strike. After what seemed like a long ride downward, he kicked away from it and swam through a cloud of red to the surface. Fear was pumping blood into Rodney's arms and legs and using them to do things he would never have done on his own. He would never have decided to fight with a great white shark, but because fear didn't give it a second thought, he survived. Rodney's wild, reckless action and Kelly's quiet, breathless action were both fueled by the same coiled-up energy, real fear. Take a moment to conjure that feeling and recognize how different it is from worry, anxiety, and panic. Even the strongest worry could not get you to fight with a shark or follow your would-be murderer silently down a hallway. Recently, I was asked to speak to a group of corporate employees about their safety. But, as is often the case, it quickly became a discussion about fear. Before I began, several people said, "Please talk to Celia. She's been looking forward to this meeting for weeks." Celia, it turned out, was eager to tell me about her dread of being followed, a topic her co-workers had heard a lot about. When people come to me in fear of a stranger, a co-worker, a spouse, a fan, my first step is always to determine if it actually is a fear as opposed to a worry or a phobia. This is fairly simple since, as I noted above, real fear occurs in the presence of danger and will always easily link to pain or death. To learn if Celia was reacting to a fear signal, which is not voluntary, or if she was worrying, which is voluntary, I asked if she feared being followed right then, right in the room where we sat. She laughed. "No, of course not. I fear it when I'm walking alone from my office to my car at night. I park in a big gated lot, and mine is always the only car left because I work the latest, and the lot is empty and it's dead silent." Since she had given me no indication of actual risk, her dread was not the fear signal of nature, but the worry only humans indulge in. To get her to link the fear, I asked what about being followed scared her. "Well, it's not the following that scares me, it's the being caught. I'm afraid somebody will grab me from behind and pull me into a car. They could do anything to me since I'm the last one here." She launched this satellite about working the latest several times. Since worry is a choice, people do it because it serves them in some way. The worry about public speaking may serve its host by giving him or her an excuse never to speak in public or an excuse to cancel or to do poorly, "because I was so scared." But how did Celia's worry serve Celia? People will always tell you what the real issue is, and in fact, Celia already had. I asked why she couldn't just leave work earlier each evening. "If I did, everybody would think I was lazy." So Celia was concerned about losing her identity as the employee who always worked the longest. Her frequent discussions of hazard and fear were guaranteed to quickly carry any conversation to the fact that she worked the latest. And that is how the worry served her. The wise words of FDR, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," might be amended by nature to, "There is nothing to fear unless and until you feel fear." Worry, wariness, anxiety, and concern all have a purpose, but they are not fear. So anytime your dreaded outcome cannot be reasonably linked to pain or death, and it isn't a signal in the presence of danger, then it really shouldn't be confused with fear. It may well be something worth trying to understand and manage, but worry will not bring solutions. It will more likely distract you from finding solutions. In the original form of the word, to worry someone else was to harass, strangle, or choke them. Likewise, to worry oneself is a form of self-harassment. To give it less of a role in our lives, we must understand what it really is. Worry is the fear we manufacture. It is not authentic. If you choose to worry about something, have at it, but do so knowing it's a choice. Most often, we worry because it provides some secondary reward. There are many variations, but a few of the most popular follow. Worry is a way to avoid change. When we worry, we don't do anything about the matter. Worry is a way to avoid admitting powerlessness over something, since worry feels like we're doing something. Prayer also makes us feel like we're doing something, and even the most committed agnostic will admit that prayer is more productive than worry. Worry is a cloying way to have connection with others, the idea being that to worry about someone shows love. The other side of this is the belief that not worrying about someone means you don't care about them. As many worried about people will tell you, worry is a poor substitute for love or for taking loving action. Worry is a protection against future disappointment. After taking an important test, for example, a student might worry about whether he failed. If he can feel the experience of failure now, rehearse it, so to speak, by worrying about it, then failing won't feel as bad when it happens. But there's an interesting trade-off. Since he can't do anything about it at this point anyway, would he rather spend 2 days worrying, then learn he failed, or spend those same 2 days not worrying, and then learn he failed? Perhaps most importantly, would he want to learn he had passed the test and spent 2 days of anxiety for nothing? In Emotional Intelligence, Daniel Goleman concludes that worrying is a sort of magical amulet that some people feel wards off danger. They believe that worrying about something will stop it from happening. He also correctly notes that most of what people worry about has a low probability of occurring, because we tend to take action about those things we feel are likely to occur. This means that very often the mere fact that you are worrying about something is a predictor that it isn't likely to happen. The relationship between real fear and worry is analogous to the relationship between pain and suffering. Pain and fear are necessary and valuable components of life. Suffering and worry are destructive and unnecessary components of life. Great humanitarians, remember, have worked to end suffering, not pain. After decades of seeing worry in all its forms, I've concluded that it hurts people much more than it helps. It interrupts clear thinking, wastes time, and shortens life. When worrying, ask yourself, how does this serve me? And you may well find that the cost of worrying is greater than the cost of changing. To be freer of fear, and yet still get its gift, there are 3 goals to strive for. They aren't easy to reach, but it's worth trying. 1. When you feel fear, listen. 2. When you don't feel fear, don't manufacture it. 3. If you find yourself creating worry, explore and discover why. Just as some people are quick to predict the worst, there are others who are reluctant to accept that they might actually be in some danger. This is often caused by the false belief that if we identify and name risk, that somehow invites or causes it to happen. This thinking says, if we don't see it and don't accept it, it is prevented from happening. Only human beings can look directly at something, have all the information they need to make an accurate prediction, perhaps even momentarily make the accurate prediction, and then say that it isn't so. One of my clients is a corporation whose New York headquarters has an excellent safety and security program. All doors into their suite of offices are kept locked. Adjacent to each entry door is a plate over which employees wave a magnetic card to gain ready access. The president of the firm asked me to speak to an employee, Arlene, who persistently refused to carry her access card. She complained that the cards scare people because they bring to mind the need for security. Call this fear of fear. Yes, she agreed, Since many employees work late at night, there is a need for a security program. But the cards and locked doors should be replaced with a guard in the lobby because the cards make the place seem like an armed camp, and they scare people. Trying to link this fear of the cards to pain or death, I asked Arlene what it is that people fear. "The cards increase the danger," she explained, "because their presence says there's something here worth taking." "Could it be," I asked, "that the cards actually reduce fear and risk, since their use means that the offices are not accessible to just anyone off the street?" "No," she told me, "people don't think that way. They'd rather not be reminded of the risk." Arlene explained that metal detectors at airports conjure the specter of hijacking as opposed to reassuring people. Tamper-proof packaging does not add comfort, it adds apprehension, and, she noted, "it's just an invitation to tamper." At the end of her confident presentation about human nature and why the cards scared people, I asked if she agreed that there could be hazard to employees if the doors were left unlocked. "Of course I do. I was assaulted one night when I worked late at my last job. The doors weren't kept locked there, and this guy walked right in. There was nobody else in the whole building, so don't tell me about danger." With that story, Arlene revealed who was afraid of the cards. She also clearly stated her philosophy for managing her fear: "Don't tell me about danger." Later, after questioning me extensively about safety in her apartment and on the subway and while shopping and when dating, she agreed to use the cards. Occasionally, we answer fears that aren't calling. Other times, we ignore those that are. And sometimes, like physician Bill McKenna, we fall somewhere in the middle. My wife, Linda, was on a business trip, so I took the girls out to dinner. We got home late. I made sure that they got to sleep and then got into bed myself. As I was dozing off, I heard a noise downstairs, which for some reason really scared me. It wasn't that it was loud, and I don't even recall exactly what it sounded like, but I absolutely couldn't shake it. So I got out of bed and went downstairs to be sure everything was all right. I made a quick walk around and then went back to bed. A half hour later, I heard a sound so quiet that I still don't know how it woke me. It was the sound of someone else's breathing. I turned on the light, and there was this guy standing in the middle of the room with my gun in his hand and our CD player under his arm. If Bill's mission on his walk downstairs was to be sure everything was all right, as he put it, then he succeeded admirably. If, though, it was to answer the survival signal, to accept the gift of fear, he failed. When he heard that noise downstairs, if he had consciously linked the fear he felt to its possible dangerous outcomes, as his intuition had already done, he would have recognized that the stakes were high, and he might have conducted his search with the goal of finding risk as opposed to the goal of finding nothing. Had he responded to his fear with respect, he would have found the intruder before the intruder found his gun. If he had said, in effect, "Since I feel fear, I know there is some reason, so what is it?" Then he could have brought into consciousness what his intuition already knew and what he later told me. The living room light was on when he got home. The cat had somehow gotten outside and was waiting on the porch. An unusual old car was parked near his driveway, its engine clinking as it cooled, and on and on. Only in the context of all these factors did that noise, which would have been inconsequential at another time, cause fear. Bill McKenna and his daughters, 4 and 5 years old, were held at gunpoint by the intruder for more than an hour. The man let the girls sit on the floor of the master bedroom and watch a videotape of Beauty and the Beast. He told Bill that he needed time to make what he called the most difficult decision of my life. He asked, "Have you ever had a really tough problem?" And Bill nodded. Bill told me he was alert until the intruder left, but that he did not feel any fear whatsoever. "When someone's already got you at gunpoint, it's too late for fear. I had more important things to focus on, like keeping the girls calm by showing them that I was okay, and keeping this guy calm."
Anyway, my fear had come and gone, and after a while, that guy had come and gone, too. Bill's lack of dread, just like his original fear on hearing the noise, made sense. First, the burglar didn't bring a gun with him, so he was not an intruder who expected or was prepared to kill. Second, his goal was fairly lightweight theft, as evidenced by the CD player he'd taken. Finally, he spoke his conscience when he said he was weighing the most difficult decision of his life. A man willing to kill would have little need to discuss his personal exploration of right and wrong with his intended victims. In fact, he would dehumanize and distance his victims, certainly not bring them into his deliberations. The intruder not only left, but he left the CD player. He did the family another favor, too. He took the gun, which now won't be available to some more dangerous intruder in the future. Bill is not replacing it. Bill let the girls watch the rest of the movie before putting them back to bed. They still recall the night the policeman with the gun visited. And it's not a traumatic story they tell. They didn't sense fear in Bill because, just as he told me, he didn't feel it. Real fear is objective, but it's clear that we are not. Meg was afraid of being killed, and Celia was afraid of being followed, even when there was nobody there. Arlene was afraid of access cards, even though they added to her safety. Bill was not afraid of an intruder, even when the man was standing in his bedroom with a gun. This all proves, as I noted early in the book, that we have odd ways of evaluating risk. Smoking kills more people every day than lightning does in a decade, but there are people who calm their fear of being struck by lightning during a storm by smoking a cigarette. It isn't logical, but logic and anxiety rarely go together. I recently met a middle-aged couple from Florida who had just obtained licenses to carry concealed handguns. The man explained why. Because if some guy walks into a restaurant and opens fire, like happened at Luby's in Texas, I want to be in a position to save lives. Of course, there are plenty of things he could carry on his belt that would be far more likely to save lives in a restaurant. An injection of adrenaline would treat anaphylactic shock, the potentially lethal allergic reaction to certain foods. Or he could carry a small sharp tube to give emergency tracheotomies to people who are choking to death. When I asked him if he carried one of those, he said, "I could never stick something into a person's throat." But he could send a piece of lead into a person's flesh like a rocket. Statistically speaking, the man and his wife are far more likely to shoot each other than to shoot some criminal. But his anxiety wasn't caused by fear of death. If it were, he would shed the excess 40 pounds likely to bring on a heart attack. His anxiety is caused by fear of people and by the belief that he cannot predict violence. Anxiety, unlike real fear, is always caused by uncertainty. It is caused, ultimately, by predictions in which you have little confidence. When you predict that you will be fired from your job and you are certain the prediction is correct, you don't have anxiety about being fired. You might have anxiety about the things you can't predict with certainty, such as the ramifications of losing the job. Predictions in which you have high confidence free you to respond, adjust, feel sadness, accept, prepare, or to do whatever is needed. Accordingly, anxiety is reduced by improving your predictions, thus increasing your certainty. It's worth doing because the word anxiety, like worry, stems from a root that means to choke. And that is just what it does to us. Our imaginations can be the fertile soil in which worry and anxiety grow from seeds to weeds. But when we assume the imagined outcome is a sure thing, we are in conflict with what Proust called an inexorable law. Only that which is absent can be imagined. In other words, what you imagine, just like what you fear, is not happening. Donna is a 29-year-old filmmaker from New York who courageously left her job and drove to Los Angeles, hoping to make significant documentaries.
She used her brightness and enthusiasm to get a meeting with a prominent film executive. About 10 miles from the meeting, her old car decided it wasn't going to take her any farther, and she was stuck directly in the center of the street. Immediately, she linked being late to all of its worst possible outcomes. "I'll miss the meeting, and they won't agree to reschedule. If you keep someone like this waiting, your chances of a career are nil, so I'll be unable to pay the rent. I'll be tossed out of my apartment. I'll end up on welfare," and on and on. Because this type of imaginative linking builds a scenario one step at a time, it feels like logic, but it is just an impersonation of logic. It's also one of our dumbest creative exercises. A passing car carrying a man and woman slowed to look at Donna, and the man called out an offer of help. Donna waved them on. Very stressed, she got out of her car and ran down the street looking for a service station, along the way adding inventive chapters to the story of her financial ruin. She noticed the same car driving alongside her, but she just kept running. Reaching a payphone, she called the studio executive's office and explained she'd be late. As she predicted, they told her the meeting could not be rescheduled. The career that she envisioned ended in that phone booth. Donna slumped and started crying just as that same car pulled up slowly toward the phone booth. Even though these people had been following her, she wasn't afraid. The man stayed in the car while the woman got out and tapped on the glass, saying, "Is that you?" Through tears, Donna looked up to see the face of Jeanette, a friend with whom she'd shared an apartment in college. Jeanette and her boyfriend rushed Donna to the meeting. She didn't get the job, and then took her to lunch. Within a few weeks, Donna and Jeanette were partners in a new business of finding art and antiques around the world for resale in America. They became so successful that within 2 years, Donna had saved enough money to co-finance her first documentary film. Amid all of Donna's creative projections when her car broke down, she hadn't included the possibility that it would lead to a reunion with an old friend with whom she'd form a business that would take her around the world and give her the resources to make her own films. Few of us predict that unexpected, undesired events will lead to great things, but very often we'd be more accurate if we did. The history of invention is filled with perceived failures that became unpredicted successes, a la James Watt's failure to get a pump working and his inadvertent success in inventing the vacuum. I've gotten great benefits from taking the voice of skepticism that I used to apply to my intuition and applying it instead to the dreaded outcomes I imagined were coming. Worry will almost always buckle under a vigorous interrogation. If you can bring yourself to apply your imagination to finding the possible favorable outcomes of undesired developments, even if only as an exercise, you'll see that it fosters creativity. This suggestion is much more than a way to find the silver lining our grandmothers encouraged us to look for. I include it in this book because creativity is linked to intuition, and intuition is the way out of the most serious challenges you might face. Albert Einstein said that when you follow intuition, the solutions come to you, and you don't know how or why. A young man named Andrew had promised to take a much-anticipated date to a particular movie she wanted to see. At first, he couldn't locate a theater showing it, and once he found where it was playing, he couldn't get tickets. He and the thus-far unimpressed girl waited in line for a second-choice film, which they learned after 40 minutes of standing was also sold out. Andrew's date was a failure, and his hopes of what young men hope for were dashed. He was, predictably, very disappointed, and he was also annoyed at the hassle of trying to see a film. He didn't immediately say to himself, "Maybe this discouraging evening will compel me to develop a new computerized phone-in system through which moviegoers can choose the film they want to see, learn where it's playing, and actually purchase the tickets in advance." But that's exactly what Andrew Jarecki did, founding MoviePhone, which you may know as 777-FILM. the innovative service used each week by millions of people in cities all over America. He also married that date. Having told so many stories of risk and harm, I share some with more favorable outcomes to make this point. Worry is a choice, and the creative genius we apply to it can be used differently, also by choice. This truth is mildly interesting when the stakes are low, like worrying about a job interview or a date. But in the situations with the highest stakes, this same truth can save your life. I've spent much of my career trying to make accurate predictions of which bad thing might happen next. Admittedly, this skill has been a powerful asset because people are eager to hear forecasts of every possible tragedy. Just one indication of this is the fact that television in large cities devotes as much as 40 hours a day to telling us about those who have fallen prey to some disaster and to exploring what calamities may be coming. New study reveals that cellular phones can kill you. Learn the facts at 11. Contaminated turkey dinner kills 3. Could your family be next? Silly and alarming news promos are of more than passing interest to me because understanding how they work is central to understanding how fear works in our culture. We watch attentively because our survival requires us to learn about things that may hurt us. That's why we slow down at the scene of a terrible car accident. It isn't out of some unnatural perversion. It is to learn. Most times we draw a lesson. He was probably drunk. They must have tried to pass. Those little sports cars are sure dangerous. That intersection is blind. Our theory is stored away, perhaps to save our lives another day. Ernest Becker explains that man's fears are fashioned out of the ways in which he perceives the world. Animals know what to fear by instinct. But an animal who has no instinct, man, has no programmed fears. Well, the local news has programmed them for us, and the audience is virtually guaranteed by one of the strongest forces in nature, our will to survive. Local news rarely provides new or relevant information about safety. But its urgent delivery mimics importance and thus gets our attention, much as someone would if they burst into your home and yelled, "Don't go outside or you'll be killed. Listen to me to save your life." That's the way local television news works as a business. Fear has a rightful place in our lives, but it isn't the marketplace. On a personal note, even though I have a professional interest in hazard and risk, I never watch the local television news and haven't for years. Try this, and you'll likely find better things to do before going to sleep than looking at 30 minutes of disturbing images presented with artificial urgency and the usually false implication that it's critical for you to see it. Electronic scare tactics come in several forms. When news is scarce, they march out an update on some old story. You might recall the bizarre kidnapping of a busload of school children in a California town called Chowchilla. The perpetrators buried the bus, with the children inside, in a massive ditch at a rock quarry. The story ended with the rescue of the 26 children and the arrest of the kidnappers. A year later came the update. All the same footage was shown, the original incident was told again in its entirety, and a reporter walked down a Chowchilla street offering this foreboding wrap-up. But the people of this little town still awaken in the night, worried that it could all happen again. They do? Worried that what could all happen again? Another mass kidnapping with a busload of their children buried in a rock quarry? I don't think so. These often ridiculous summaries are used to give news stories significance or to leave them uncertain and thus open for still further stories, e.g., whether more will die remains to be seen. In the world of local news, frightening stories never end. We rarely hear the words, "And that's that." Local news has several favorite phrases, one of which is, "Police made a gruesome discovery today in name of local city." The satellite age has increased the library of available shocking footage, so that now, if there wasn't a something grisly in your town, you might hear, "Police made a gruesome discovery today in Reno, or Chicago, or Miami, or even Caracas."
It may not be local, but it is gruesome. And there's some footage, so what the hell? Whether they go back in time to find something shocking or go around the planet, in neither case is the information necessarily valuable or relevant to your life. Local news has become little more than what information anxiety author Richard Saul Wurman calls a list of inexorable deaths, accidents, and catastrophes, the violent wallpaper of our lives. I discuss all this here as much more than a pet peeve. Understanding how the television news works and what it does to you is directly relevant to your safety and well-being. First, the fear of crime is itself a form of victimization. But there is a much more practical issue involved. Being exposed to constant alarm and urgency shell shocks us to the point that it becomes impossible to separate the survival signal from the sound bite. Because it's sensationalism and not informationalism, we get a distorted view of what actually poses a hazard to us. Imagine a widely televised report. Dolphin attacks swimmer. Such a story would make a new connection in the minds of literally millions of people. Dolphins are dangerous to man, which they are not. Though unusual animal attack stories are good news fodder. Humans are not the favored prey of any predator. We are somewhat bony, low on meat, and smart as the dickens. The point is that your survival brilliance is wasted when you focus on unlikely risks. Unfortunately, just giving a criminal hazard a name gives it a place in our minds and gives us another reason to feel unwarranted fear of people. Think back to the so-called freeway shootings in Los Angeles. Though television news was full of interviews with motorists pointing out bullet holes in their windshields, the fact is that there were fewer freeway shootings that year than there had been the year before. There was no trend, no rash of attacks, no criminal fad, nothing any different than what had happened before or has happened since. But we don't hear anything these days about freeway shootings. Are there no more hot days and angry armed motorists stuck in slow traffic? Have freeway shootings really stopped? Or have the reports stopped because the story is an episode from last season? The only real trend is the way local news finds two similar stories with some striking visuals or an overly excited interview, gives the risk a name, and repeats it for a while with different victims. When such a crime succeeds, the local news will tell people how it was done. Thus, supposedly new forms of criminal violence can indeed become fads, through the very same method that other fads do. It's called advertising. A serious-looking news celebrity tells of the most current danger we simply must know about to save our lives. I'm standing at the scene of the latest follow-home robbery to hit this posh West Side neighborhood, part of a growing trend of random attacks. How can you avoid this terror? This will be followed by a list of cautions, some of them so obvious as to be comical, e.g., don't let strangers into your car. There will be an interview with someone seriously billed as a follow-home robbery expert. Then suddenly one day you think such robberies had just stopped because local television will move on to the next criminal hazard. Soon it will be robbers who hide out in your purse until you get home, followed by a checklist of warning signs to look out for. Purse feels extra heavy, purse difficult to close, unusual sounds coming from purse. Though television news would have us think differently, the important question is not how we might die, but rather, how shall we live? And that is up to us. In my life and work, I've seen the darkest parts of the human soul. At least I hope they are the darkest. That has helped me see more clearly the brightness of the human spirit. Feeling the sting of violence myself has helped me feel more keenly the hand of human kindness. Given the frenzy and the power of the various violence industries, the fact that most Americans live without being violent is a sign of something wonderful in us. In resisting both the darker sides of our species and the darker sides of our heritage, it is everyday Americans, not the icons of big-screen vengeance, who are the real heroes.
Abraham Lincoln referred to the better angels of our nature, and they must surely exist, for most of us make it through every day with decency and cooperation. Having spent years preparing for the worst, I finally arrived at this wisdom. Though the world is a dangerous place, it is also a safe place. You and I have survived some extraordinary risks, particularly given that every day we move in, around, and through powerful machines that could kill us without missing a cylinder. Jet airplanes, subways, buses, escalators, elevators, motorcycles, cars. Conveyances that carry a few of us to injury, but most of us to the destinations we have in mind. We are surrounded by toxic chemicals, and our homes are hooked up to explosive gases and lethal currents of electricity. Most frightening of all, we live among armed and often angry countrymen. Taken together, these things make every day a high-stakes obstacle course our ancestors would shudder at. But the fact is, we are usually delivered through it. Still, rather than be amazed at the wonder of it all, millions of people are actually looking for things to worry about. Near the end of his life, Mark Twain wisely said, "I have had a great many troubles, but most of them never happened." You now know a great deal about predicting and avoiding violence, from the dangers posed by strangers to the brutality inflicted on friends and family members, from the everyday violence that can touch anyone to the extraordinary crimes that will touch only a few. With your intuition better informed, I hope you will have less unwarranted fear of people. I hope you'll harness and respect your ability to recognize survival signals. Most important, I hope you'll see hazard only in those storm clouds where it exists and live life more fully in the clear skies between them.
Context of white supremacy. So technically we are all done with Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear. Survival signals that protect us from violence. However, with the audiobook, there is an epilogue. I don't even have the epilogue in my ebook. I have an appendix, but you know, I don't think it's exactly the, well, we'll see. But I don't think it's exactly the same. So we do have a second audio segment, the epilogue, that was written a few years after the initial publication of this text, which was 1997. If listeners, if you have thoughts, questions, concluding thoughts, questions on Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear, the number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Make sure you share the broadcast on social media. Let folks know the book club is live. Or if you're listening to the archive, you can share as well. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Wow. To be reading this book on this week, we had neighbors have a domestic dispute that spilled outside. I literally watched it out of my window at my residence. I said first time, last time, so frequently, because it was non-white people, this week, in talking about that incident. First time, last time, I said it repeatedly. And I even came back in referencing this book and saying, "Oh, looking at somebody's behavior. Gavin De Becker said that looking at people's behavior, that is the best indicator, especially if we're talking about some sort of future violence. Have they done this sort of thing before?" Zero tolerance. I should have recommended this book. My first instinct was first time, last time. Be definitive about that. Whew, to be reading this book on this week. Wow. Finishing this book, no less. Finishing this book. Folks who dialed in, if you have, as I said, a concluding thought on what we've read the past few weeks, specifically what we heard today, star 6-1. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments to share, lines should be open. Proceed. Folks are getting their thoughts together. I'll share a few.
Yes, sir.
Oh, there's Mr. Demery for. Greetings, sir.
Yes. May I be heard, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. What I want to bring attention to first in this last reading is that I've noticed that in a lot of literature and in the racist rhetoric, there's coded phrases. And when they talk about these places that are considered dangerous in this last reading, it's generally the areas with the largest non-white population. And he mentioned Los Angeles a lot, you know, when he was talking about fear. And based on these examples that he used, I would say that they were white people, because when he gave the information about the the word that would cause the most psychological fear, and it came out to be the word shark, I thought that if we were talking about non-white people, or and specifically black people, I think that the word may have been a little different. But what comes to mind first to me is police or 5-0. Or if you're in a crowded place and somebody yell gun or bomb, you know, would seem to strike more psychological fear in, let's say, an area where there would be a large concentration of non-white people, in my assumption. And when he started talking about the media, and I'll give somebody else a chance, I thought about the fact that when the news is given, most of the time we see black faces being posted on the media or local news. And then if the perpetrator is a white person, then their pictures are withheld. And I think that intelligent fear is something that, you know, we would cultivate as constructive, as opposed to being paranoid or having some type of unwarranted fear. I mean, in a system of white supremacy, we could just get to the point that we become paranoid and would rather not even go out that day, because there's no telling, you know, what could happen. He gave instances of females that were something happening to them in a parking lot. But when we are shot down and terrorized every day, I could see where a large portion of non-whites, especially black people, would take on some paranoid behavior and not want to, or to feel anxiety a lot more than a few occasions. But I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery, for a great point about the word shark. If you were to see what word popped up in association with fear, it might be different for a population of black people, victims of white supremacy. You did mention Mr. Fuller's concept, intelligent fear. Great mention for the broadcast. For folks who've not heard that term, it is in the word guide, the definition. Use this term to apply to the fear that a non-white person has of a white supremacist while that non-white person is speaking and or acting to replace the system of white supremacy with the system of justice. Intelligent fear is a form of cautious and calculated courage. Others who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening. Mr. Demery, you all the callers. Good reading. The book was, to me, it was decent. I got a lot out of it, but it was a lot of, I didn't like about it. But he mentioned one of my favorite things, the white great shark, or the great white shark. And I love this because great and white are synonyms to each other, at least according to the English dictionary. And, this dangerous animal, which I think we could all attest, the last thing you want to be is in the water and see a fin come up on you, is called white twice. You know, the white shark is right there telling you a lot with that. And he said because it strikes unpredictably. And it's deadly. And, I always equate the great white shark to white power. Works the same way. You never know when it's going to strike, but you know when it does strike, it's going to be deadly. You know, I think a lot of what we call black-on-black crime happens because there's definitely knowledge that, you know, if you commit a crime to one of the white person, that there'll be consequences and repercussions. More so than, you're definitely going to get an investigation, So I think that, that just like that great white shark. You mentioned intuition is important, and I just don't believe in intuition to make decisions or, they call it instincts too. I believe that's 50-50, hit or miss. The opposite of intuition, I looked up the antonyms. First one that pops up, information, learning, instruction, elaboration, acquirement, induction, experience. I study white people. They do not use intuition when they make decisions. They use information. They pretty much map everything out. If you come to a fork in a road, I would rather use information and intuition. Which way should I go? Whites have maps, radars, LIDAR, GPS. They come with information. You know what I'm saying? They're not sitting there back worried. We are always using intuition. And to me, information tells us that whites are racist and dangerous. Intuition keeps telling us that our information is wrong. This white person isn't that bad, and these white people aren't that dangerous. We always end up in that intuition. You know, we stick with the information. I think that that's a code. That goes to the codification. As for the book, I think that it was good. I found it was a lot of contradictions, especially, I think it was written for white women. Some of the contradictions I think I pointed out last week that was major to me because based off of his expert opinion with no references or anything, that these stars are shouldn't be reaching out to fears. I mean, it's in this age, everyone has a social media account and they're talking to their fans. That's how they build their so-called brand. They call it a, these people tell me they got a brand. white for brand, you know. But either way, they're building their brand. And, you know, Nicki Minaj, she has such and such amount of millions of people that follow her. That, you know, she's sending them happy birthdays on their birthday. It's a total different, and I don't see these people being stalked and killed. So, in fact, the only people I see being killed is, you know, Nipsey Hussle, you know, or they come up on them and shoot them, like, you know, how things normally happen. So it just doesn't, you know, pan out for me, a lot of the things he's saying, especially the situation too, because he knows white people use information because he's white. And he's using information to solve these cases, chasing a murderer for a couple of weeks in the hills. How did you know he was there without information? He wasn't using intuition, you know. So I'll meet my line, Gus, and good book.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed. There, it's combination of things. I think I'm going slow on the switchboard, and then people are slowly getting their notes together. So hopefully we'll all get it together. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I also agree that this is a good book. I listened to the audiobook all at once, and I think that it was a really, it gave me more insight on the racist fears of white people, or racist worries, I guess, if we're going by Mr. DeBecker's terminology. Even like with just a couple things just from this last segment, when he spoke about how prayer was useless. I thought that was interesting, and definitely if this was, you know, something written for anyone, no matter of race, just based on all the confusion with non-white, especially black people, I wouldn't say that would be something that, especially like from my understanding, older black women, especially your black women, period, would co-sign. But I thought that was interesting. And then him constantly, you know, bringing up these different, what I assume to be white damsels in distress. And with the example about the woman at work and who didn't want to use a badge. And it definitely, to me, seemed like that was, you know, another example of a white woman, because, you know, white black people can get fired for such small things. And even I've even heard, like, had different positions where if you didn't sign in, or if you didn't, you know, bring in a badge or something like that, then you, so many of those times you would get fired, and you had this person actually refusing to do that. And I think I can't remember what chapter it was in, but there was also the time with the white man, and he felt like he was owed some money, and that's when the company brought in Mr. DeBecker and his group or whatever, and they decided to come to the conclusion of just going ahead and give this person some money. And that's also made it seem like, when it came to mind, it made me think of a white man. But even though it seems like this book is more of a self-help book for females, I definitely feel like I wouldn't be able to use this in my normal life, or in my life or whatever. And I guess that's where I'll leave it for now. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. Wow, this book is about 13, 14 hours? That is massive. Take all that in one chunk. Right on. Other folks who we missed totally, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary to share, concluding commentary, because we are all done with the gift of fear. If you haven't shared, you have comments, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. My thought is about his being that the book was created in the late 90s. There's been a lot more. They're not new, but it has drawn a lot of much more frequency and attention worldwide with the concern and or fear in the workplace of education. The incidents that have taken place just in areas where people quote unquote shop, and how he would diagnose those type of incidents that's been going on. And it would be inescapable to make these reports on these quote unquote mass shootings and not talk about racism, white supremacy at the same time, being that the killers stated in their documents, written documents, and also some of the articles that they left behind at their home about their intent and their interest for what they did. So in that part, I think the book would have to get updated, and I'm being nice about saying that, that it has to be updated, being that it was, you know, some of the, and also I agree with Thomas when he was saying that the whole thing about information is what white people rely upon. I mean, even the most violent white people, I'm talking about those people who wear uniforms and go worldwide, they base their violence off of information. The quote unquote great generals and those sort of people who are the top number purveyors of fear on the planet. It's interesting how he brought up Fiji. Am I correct?
Yep.
In the first part of the reading, he brought up the island of Fiji.
Yep.
Yeah, and I mean, if anybody knows a little bit about the history behind atomic bombs, that's where they were. Use those areas as bombing grounds for experimenting these weapons. And I thought it was interesting that he made a visit there or something. And of course the people are going to be mutated, I guess. I imagine just the sound of something like that taking place would strike fear, let alone talking about the number of years that I've studied that they experimented with that type of weaponry. I don't know. It's some things in it, I guess, that people can take from the book and, you know, file it either on paper or file it in their memories as far as to some signs that would educate them on something bad or incorrect happening. But he would really have to update it on based on what took place from the late 90s to where people find themselves at today when it comes to violence and or fear. And those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter, but also have to add quite an addendum for Arenthal James. But other folks, if we missed you totally, if you haven't got to share at all and you have any comments, questions that you would like to add, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Can you hear me well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I'm actually laughing at something else. But anyway, maybe I'm mistaken, but the last time I checked, men were way more often victims of violence than women. If you look at the FBI statistics, you're going to get over 70% of men, you know, with just as victims of violence, and you're going to get the same thing with the National Crime Victim Surveys, and you're going to get that in every area except for rape. And that's what's so wonderful about Dr. Curry, because he brought out the information that even in rape, the numbers are very, very close. So for overall violence, men are way more often victims of violence than women. And it's just, so it just seems that his entire premise is off and is incorrect. So I don't understand why he would say something like that. And it also seems that he's, I guess, propagating that most of the violence that even women suffer are from other men, which isn't true at all. It's mostly from other women, because first of all, men ain't trying to go to jail like that anyway, because they look at it wrong and they go into jail. So I don't understand that, and also, to me, there wasn't enough warnings and solutions about violence. To me, there was too much propaganda and talking points, like with the, you know, the Al Sharpton and stuff like that. That stuff didn't even need to be in there at all. If he's really just trying to, you know, help people with violence, excuse me. Also, when I believe it was the video where he was talking about the mass murders, and you, Gus, you sent the link to that, and I believe it was in that video he talked about tuition, and he was advising that we substitute logic for intuition, which is very dangerous to substitute logic for anything. And he was talking about how he described, because I remember the firefighter, he asked probably in the beginning of this book study, what was the author's definition of intuition? Well, from that video, he described intuition as just this feeling, just this gut feeling. And that may have been, you know, stated, you know, on the program during the book study. I just don't quite remember. I want to say it may have been, but I don't quite remember. But yeah, he definitely described it as just this gut feeling, how he tried to justify using that or making that, or how can I say, he tried to justify elevating that over logic and stressing that was more important to pay attention to, this gut feeling that you may have, versus logic. So that's a mess. And the last thing in that video about the mass murders, how he sat there and made heroes out of these murderers. He did that because they were white. If they were black or not white, especially if they were black, there's no way that he would have used any example. There wouldn't have been anything that he would have used to make them a hero. I mean, he was just, he was really reaching when he was making them heroes. Something about they weren't afraid to die and all this nonsense. And it's like, that's what race soldiers do. Because I guess because they see themselves in any white person. So if any white person does something wrong, they're a hero or they're mentally ill or whatever the case may be. And then he was also, of course, showing his racism just with his commentary on Reverend Al Sharpton and O.J. Simpson and things like that. Like, he is a staunch racist as well. He reminds me a lot, actually, of the male that was on the other night, Jason Miller, Dr. Jason Miller, I think it was. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. That was the video I posted where Mr. DeBecca was talking about the Columbine shooting from around the time, late 90s, when this book was published. The lecture was after the book was published, but he referenced the white killers as being courageous in the audio segment. I played a little bit of the intro for last week. Anywho, Star 6-1, if you all have additional comments, you can. The remarks about this book being geared towards women as the quintessential victims of violence in the United States, keep that point in mind as we move to the epilogue coming shortly. Some of the notes that I took from chapter 15, final chapter of the text. Scooting back, let's see. When he says, when you honor accurate intuitive signals and evaluate them without denial, believing that either the favorable or the unfavorable outcome is possible, you need not be wary. That stuck out to me. It even reminded me when Thomas in New York was speaking earlier, something is flawed about our assessment, the signals that we are getting about whites. Either we're getting the signals and we are ignoring them, and or we are processing the information incorrectly. That has got to be the case, not understanding racism, white supremacy. That has to be happening on a regular basis. And I suspect that for a lot of us, when we start getting a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, you might have some of the same experiences where you can look back at interactions, experiences with whites, and see, oh, okay, the information was there, I missed it. Let's see. Next, but being accurate without denial. I thought that was so clue, especially for what I just said. I think sometimes we get that information and we deny. The clues are right there. This gal is a racist. This fellow's a racist. The denial comes in not being honest with ourselves about racism, white supremacy. Sometimes I think that is a problem. Frequently, actually. He says some Darwinians believe that early humans who were most afraid were most likely to survive. The result, says Becker, is the emergence of a man as we know him, a hyper-anxious animal who constantly invents reasons for anxiety even when there are none. It need not be this way. That reminded me a lot of Dr. Welsing's theory of white genetic annihilation, the constant anxiety on a planet dominated by individuals classified as not white. And particularly, we've talked about the influence of Darwin's ideology in the system of white supremacy and that entire way of thinking, survival of the fittest, and that the best qualified of the species is the one that is most fearful, has the most anxiety. That's, I mean, everything about that as I am processing it sounds like
white genetic annihilation. That would spur all sorts of creativity, vigilance, aggression, certainly, but that would motivate us to survive. Maybe I'm misinterpreting. Let's see. When he's talking about, retired firefighter talked about him, him visiting Fiji and the connection to white supremacy, racism there, the atomic bomb tests. He says that, make sure I get, okay. Heading back toward the plantation where I was staying. Plantation in Fiji. Sounds like white supremacy racism, and it reminded me, this is from the book club, and we had the author on, Katrina After the Flood. We read that in 2015. I know it's 2015 because it was 10-year anniversary of Katrina, so we read that 4 years ago this summer. This is what we were reading, 2015 in August. But in that book, the white author, he stayed at a plantation to cover the first portion of Hurricane Katrina. That, you know, the again, same thing, whether it's Fiji or the plantation specifically, there's so many references to white supremacy racism, although it's not mentioned specifically, explicitly. Next, you all already mentioned the Great White. I thought that was Thomas in New York talking about that's almost saying white two times and praising the Great White for its speed and brute strength. Praising another form of praising a white killer, whether it's the white child killers at Columbine or the sharks in the ocean, but praise for white killers that we do not see for accused like Arenthal James. Let's see. He says we do know human violence is rarely random and rarely without warning. Now, I paused on that one. I said, I don't know. Is that true? I have to think. He mentioned that shark attack, and Thomas in New York said that that's symptomatic of the system of white supremacy. I don't know. You got a Dylann Roof. Now, the symptoms were there. He had been saying this, but I mean, for the victims, they weren't around him, so they didn't get all those cues. For the victims, that was their first time seeing him. I mean, unless you're just immediately fearful of whites, which would be logical and accurate system of white supremacy, I don't know. Seems like he was kind of random, without warning. Didn't say anything, didn't do anything. I think I could probably go through quite a few examples. Jerry Kelly, that white woman who just snatched those four children down at gunpoint, didn't seem like there was a whole lot of warning. I'm not sure if that is true in a system of white supremacy. It seems like I could probably, if I put my mind to it, I could probably come up with a hefty list of examples of white terrorists attacking without warning, random, seemingly. Let's see. He says, anytime your dreaded outcome cannot be reasonably linked to pain or death and isn't a single signal in the presence of danger, then it really shouldn't be confused with fear. It may well be something worth trying to understand and manage, but worry will not bring you solutions. It will more likely distract you from finding solutions. I did think that that was constructive in terms of worry, because I think that can consume a lot of energy where it's not really going towards problem solving. I think Dr. Welsing talked about how we'll get stuck in the problem perception and we never get to the solution point. And that is crucial. Getting out of the worry where we're just wasting energy and getting to how can we solve this problem, at least moving in the direction of solving this problem. Let's see. Yeah, it's right there. He says, worry is a way to avoid change. When we worry, we don't do anything about the matter. Worry is a way to avoid admitting powerlessness over something. Since worry feels like we're doing something, prayer also makes us feel like we're doing something. Even the most committed agnostic, will admit that prayer is more productive than worry. And I thought, even when he put that in parentheses, that they often encourage us to pray about white supremacy racism. Worry, prayer, we could do better than those two. Those are not moving towards a solution. Let's see. Again, the anecdotes, I mean, we just have to take it, I guess, at his word that these are accurate, truthful. Two more things I'll get in. He says, in my life and work, I've seen the darkest parts of the human soul. At least I hope they are the darkest. And then he comes down a few sentences later, in resisting both the darker sides of our species and the darker sides of our heritage. I thought that was huge. The darker sides of our heritage. I don't even know what that means. The Negroes, I guess. It is everyday Americans, not the Negroes, not the icons of big screen vengeance, who are the real heroes. Speaking of heroes, Abraham Lincoln referred to the better angels of our nature, and they must surely exist. For most of us make it through the everyday with decency and cooperation. I feel that is a total lie. You cannot have a system of racism, white supremacy worldwide, and then say, conclude that we make it through every day with decency and cooperation. We do not. We make it through every day with violence and deception in some form, shape, or another. And to have Abraham Lincoln here, again, that's why I said there's so many references to white supremacy racism. This Better Angels is all about enslaving the Negroes. Again, you keep slipping that in. Gavin DeBecker keeps slipping that in. All these references, Al Sharpton, O.J. Simpson, Fiji, Abraham Lincoln, all of these go back even to World War II, Kamikaze. All of these things directly relate to white supremacy racism, but he's not talking about that. If you're going to talk about violence and fear, the violence on this planet, individuals classified as white, anxious about dark people. And then the last thing, when he gave that example about Bill, this intruder broke into the house, had their children at gunpoint, and then left, didn't take the CD player. I think at least the way that he spoke about intuition that seemed to make some sort of sense was like in this example, where he says Bill heard this sound. His intuition told him to get up and check. I guess he did, but he did a poor effort. Didn't find the intruder, went back to sleep, got up later, and the guy found his gun, and there we go. Where he continued with that anecdote, and he said that Bill had noted that the light was left on in the house. There was this odd car parked outside, that there was a lot of information that he could have used in conjunction with hearing that sound that could have led to a different result in that situation. And I think, at least in for me, the way that it makes sense, using logic, using information, those are key to your safety, to our safety. But when you get those signals, I think what he said before, you don't get those signals too often to hear a sound where it's, whoa, what is that? That was upsetting. To go ahead and say, hey, that doesn't happen every day where I hear something. Use logic and investigate and see if there is anything. To go ahead and explore, come to a conclusion using logic, and then move forward. I think, at least in my view, that makes, I can see how that makes sense. Not abandoning logic, but just if in that specific context, when we're talking about violence, evaluating your environment situations, you get cues, you get signals, you evaluate using logic, that information, and try to come to the best decision. In that context, that setting seems to make sense. We can talk about that more once we get past the epilogue. He goes right to Oprah Winfrey. So this is the epilogue. This was published or written after the anniversary. Book had already come out, so he's talking about some of the success. Might be even some narcissism here. You have to listen. If you have additional comments, questions, write it down. We should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. So this is technically we're done. But this is the epilogue to Gavin DeBecker, suspected racist, The Gift of Fear, Context of White Supremacy, our last segment.
Epilogue. As I write this, it's been nearly a year since The Gift of Fear was first published, nearly a year since I sat next to Oprah Winfrey as she told her viewers that every woman in America should read this book. She added, it could save your life one day. I had hoped, maybe even expected, that it might be true. I did not, however, expect thousands of letters from readers, women and men, parents, teachers, students, police officers, prosecutors, children. I did not expect that all over America there were readers who had faced personal hazards, which they successfully managed by applying ideas they had read about in The Gift of Fear.
Their letters were gifts to me and continue to be. Among those who decided to get the book on the basis of Oprah's suggestion was a California woman named Janet. Before she could buy it, however, she was given a copy by her daughter, Blair, who was attending college in Arizona. Within weeks of reading it, both women got a pop quiz on the material. Blair was in danger. Blair was living in a small rented house off campus with two other young women, Amanda and Cheryl. They all got along well, mostly, but Blair's letter to me described one persistent problem. Cheryl's boyfriend, Nick, who was in the Marines. Blair and Amanda did not want Nick around the house, and with good reason. He scared them. Earlier in the year, he had attempted suicide in their dorm, and his general instability made them apprehensive. Because of Nick's relationship with Cheryl, the girls felt they had to allow his visits. But when he dropped out of the military and dropped back into their lives, Blair was alarmed. Amanda, who had always said she wouldn't tolerate Nick being around, suddenly lost the nerve to insist he leave, probably because she was afraid. Only Blair refused to deny the obvious. Nick wasn't going anywhere. He was not looking for a job, he was not looking for an apartment, and something needed to be done. Blair discussed the situation with her mother, and having just read this book, they quickly noted some of the warning signs of intimate violence from Chapter 10. Nick's controlling behavior toward Cheryl, not letting her see friends, deciding what she could wear, etc., and his rabid jealousy, persistently calling Cheryl, demanding to know what she was doing, whom she was with. They noted Cheryl's refusal to see any of this. Blair kept trying to get Amanda to focus on the fact that Nick was basically living in their house. Her letter describes how she felt. I couldn't sleep. I could not feel comfortable in that house, and the whole time a voice in my head was telling me to get out, that something was going to happen. She made one last effort to fortify the will of her housemates, but the meeting was a failure. When it came time to be direct with Cheryl, Amanda stunned me by saying she had no problem with Nick. This after more than a year of telling me she was afraid of him. When it came down to standing up for what she believed, she caved. I did not. I was confident that you, your book, and my inner voice knew better than anyone else in that room. Throughout this period, Blair kept her mother apprised of the situation, and Janet decided to contact the parents of the other girls and discuss the situation. Each parent told Janet that, yes, they also disliked Nick. They told her they wished he'd leave, but wishing does little to make it happen. One had even asked Nick to leave that very day, but asking did no more than wishing. It was clear to Janet that the other parents were not willing to intervene. The theme of these phone calls with the parents was that Janet was overreacting to a matter that her daughter could handle on her own. Admittedly, Janet was torn between being a friend to an adult daughter and mothering someone who had already left the nest, and this made it difficult for her to know what, if anything, to do next. The other parents had different levels of concern and different ideas to offer, but even Cheryl's parents solidly agreed on one thing. Nick was not dangerous. Cheryl, meanwhile, had been telling Nick every detail of these discussions, and the day after Janet called the other parents, Nick stormed into Blair's room and said, "This is all your fault. You better be willing to pay the consequences in the future." Janet would have loved the peace that denial brought to the other parents, but not if the cost was her daughter's safety. Then she heard from her daughter about the pay the consequences warning. Then she heard that two of the girls were now referring to Nick as psycho. A few days later, Nick surprised everyone by moving out, but what looked like good news to the other girls looked like trouble to Blair. She felt Nick was not someone to just give up. More important, her intuition was sending her an emergency signal. "He's going to kill Cheryl. I just know it," she told her mother. Janet listened, and without hesitation, she set off to get Blair out of that house. Later she told me, "You may stop parenting, but you never stop being a parent." Janet did not rest for a moment after her 10-hour drive to Blair's house. Wordlessly, mother and daughter rushed through their packing. They shared a powerful sense of urgency they couldn't explain, and didn't have to explain, to anyone.
Soon enough, Blair's stuff was in the car, and so was she, and for the first time in weeks, they both felt safe. That's the undramatic end of Blair's story, but not the end of Cheryl's. Within 1 hour of Blair's moving out, Nick arrived at the house with a gun and kidnapped Cheryl. He tied her hands and then drove around aimlessly, first to a remote desert area and later to the small motel where he'd been staying. Nick parked the car there, and as he yelled various threats at Cheryl, some employees of a nearby store looked on and concluded that the couple was just arguing. A woman shopper, with much courage and no denial, ran over and yelled to the store employees, "He's got a gun in the car. Call the cops." Cheryl's own fears, no longer deniable, were now free to empower her. She struggled with Nick, finally got out of the car and ran toward the store. The employees, now acting quickly, locked Cheryl in a storeroom just as Nick arrived. Frustrated at losing her and filled with rage and self-hate, Nick grabbed a bottle of cleaning fluid from a shelf, wailing, "I want to die." He drank it down, an odd attempt at suicide for a man with a gun. Realizing he couldn't get to Cheryl, Nick fled the store and was apprehended by police the following day. He has now been indicted for several offenses, including kidnapping. It's easy to understand and to forgive Blair's former housemates and their parents for their unwillingness to see hard truths about danger. But even after a kidnapping at gunpoint, all the other parents remained experts at denial to the end, choosing to blame Blair for causing Nick's behavior. Thankfully, Blair knows very well that she could not and did not make Nick into a violent man. Would they blame her for his suicide attempt months earlier, his troubles in the military, his abusive and obsessive behavior toward Cheryl? The forces at work inside Nick were there long before he met Blair. Because Janet and Blair listened to their intuition in spite of the criticism of others, they never had to learn what would have happened if Blair had been in the house when Nick burst in with a gun. A week after hearing from Janet, I received a letter from another remarkable parent. Melanie and her 13-year-old son, Brian, were taking a trip to a few places around the country. Brian's father had died some months earlier, and this vacation was for healing. The trip went well until Los Angeles, where they ran into a small snag at the hotel. It turned out to be a snag that lasted a year. At the front desk, they were told the rooms wouldn't be ready for at least an hour. Confident in the hotel's reputation, Melanie agreed to leave their bags in the care of the front desk clerk. Well, at least in the vicinity of the front desk clerk. Then she and Brian took a casual walk through the shops near the hotel. Back an hour later, the clerk gave them this mixed message. "Your rooms are ready, but if those were your suitcases left over there, they were inadvertently loaded onto our courtesy van, taken to the airport, and unloaded there. We're trying to find them. And oh, yeah, sorry about the confusion." The clerk was not full of creative ideas on how to resolve this rather enormous inconvenience, and, in fact, had fallen nearly silent. So Melanie asked to speak to someone else. "The assistant manager, Mr. Hudson, is already working on the problem," the clerk said, pointing to a man who was speaking to Brian. "That's odd," Melanie thought. "He's talking to my son instead of me. Well, at least he's talking." As Melanie crossed the lobby to join them, she heard the assistant manager say, "I'm pretty sure I can get you a tennis racket signed by Andre Agassi." Brian had apparently shared his passion for tennis with this man, and though a signed racket would be a great gift, it wouldn't address their more immediate needs. But Mr. Hudson was prepared to help there, too. He arranged for them to have a two-bedroom suite, provided toothbrushes, toothpaste, two hairbrushes, and, most helpful, a $250 credit at a department store adjacent to the hotel. As a last gesture, he even arranged to have their air tickets upgraded to first class for the flight back to Chicago. All in all, it wasn't a bad ending for their trip. Except that Mr. Hudson's generosity didn't stop there. One afternoon, a few weeks after getting home, Melanie found Brian sitting in the kitchen, chatting amiably with someone on the phone. She prided herself on that special skill many mothers have, the ability to tell from only one side of a conversation exactly whom their kids are speaking with. But this conversation didn't track normally. Was it one of his friends? Brian was too reserved for that. Was it a stranger? Too familiar for that. The call was about all the usual topics, sports, computers, the internet, but it also had some unusual topics, clothes, travel, and a really odd one, local tourism. Finally, the world's leading expert on all things Brian admitted to herself that she was stumped. She mouthed, "Who's that?" Brian covered the phone with his hand and said, "Eddie." "Who's Eddie?" "You remember that guy who helped us at the hotel in L.A.? I talked to him last week, and he said he was coming to town. Well, he's here and wants to know if I can show him the beaches around Lake Michigan." Melanie recalled how helpful Mr. Hudson, now Eddie, had been, and Brian had certainly liked him. Seeing the guy might be okay, but she wasn't comfortable with the idea of a lake outing. She told Brian that Eddie could stop by for a visit, but that was all. Eddie arrived at their home the following day with a tennis racket for Brian. Not signed, but a beautiful racket nonetheless. He and Brian sat in the living room talking, and Melanie put her head in briefly to say hello. A few weeks later, Eddie visited again. On this trip, he spent some time with Brian and a couple of his friends. After Eddie left, Brian approached his mother with a big request. Eddie had offered to take Brian to a tennis tournament in Atlanta. Given the loss of his father, Melanie felt that spending some time with a man might be good for Brian, but not a man they barely knew, and not on an out-of-town trip. Melanie told her very disappointed son that they'd have to say no. She did, however, agree to Brian's plea to at least talk to Eddie about it. Eddie presented a stronger case for the trip. It would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Brian loves tennis, and he'd meet lots of other kids his age interested in the game. They would be back in a day and a half, and the entire trip would be free. Just as Melanie was thinking it was all a little too generous, Eddie offered her 2 round-trip tickets to anywhere in the United States for her own use. Melanie told Eddie she'd think about it, and she did. She also talked to a few friends who felt she should take Eddie's offer. The friend who most favored the idea was, not surprisingly, the very one who'd get the free trip with Melanie. Melanie considered the fact that Brian really enjoyed spending time with Eddie. Most of all, she considered that Eddie seemed to be, no, he was, a very nice man. But something didn't feel right. Recall the story in Chapter 4 about Billy, the man on the plane who was trying to pick up a young girl? It showed that some predictions can be made solely on the basis of context. Melanie had just read Chapter 4 when she systematically and objectively recounted to herself the context of the situation. A man you meet in a professional capacity, say the assistant manager of a hotel, retains your phone number and then calls your 13-year-old son directly. He makes 2 trips halfway across the country to visit a boy he barely knows and then invites the boy on an out-of-town trip. That was enough information for Melanie. In spite of Brian's persistent lobbying and substantial disappointment, Melanie said no to the trip. She also made another decision that would be even less popular with her son and with Eddie. One evening after Eddie had taken Brian and 2 of his friends to a movie, she asked to talk to him alone. "I am not comfortable about your being in Brian's life, and I've decided that it stops tonight. Thanks for all you've done, and I'll explain my decision to my son." Oddly enough, Eddie didn't ask why, didn't negotiate, didn't in fact say much at all. He simply went away. Melanie felt that Eddie's immediate acceptance of her decision seemed suspicious. Later, however, seeing Brian's sadness, she wondered if her intuition had misguided her. She didn't have to wonder for long. A few weeks after Eddie was out of their lives, he still wasn't out of Brian's mind, and there was a good reason. Though Brian was reluctant to tell his mother, it turns out that Eddie had regularly discussed sex and pornography with him. One evening when Brian had 2 friends over, Melanie had gone out for an hour. In that time, Eddie had come over with a videotape he showed the boys. It was hardcore pornography. Melanie eventually got all these disturbing details, but if Brian had been allowed to travel with Eddie, there would doubtless have been many more. She had saved her son from the worst kind of damage, the kind often done by nice men. I heard other remarkable stories this year, like the one in a letter from a woman named Barbara. She had lost two friends in her life, each killed by a different serial killer. The first was one of five women murdered in San Mateo County, California in 1976. Barbara doesn't know who killed that friend because the murders were never solved. In the second case, however, Barbara knows exactly who did the killing. In fact, she knew it before the murders even happened. In her letter, she explained, "At first I had no idea that the two people my roommate brought into our house would eventually kill her. However, I reacted to their presence as if she had brought the devil incarnate into our home. Indeed, she had. Karen wanted them to stay with us, arguing they had no place to live, but I insisted that they leave immediately. Sadly, Karen decided to leave with them." Those two people Barbara met were Susan and Michael Carson, the serial killers mentioned in Chapter 12. "I know that Karen could have prevented her own murder if she'd only had the same initial fear reaction to the Carsons that I had. I was able to protect myself and the others living with us, but I was unable to protect Karen. Listening to my intuition has saved my life, probably more times than I am aware of." I heard from a woman named Sarah. "It wasn't until I started reading your book that I realized how much my intuition had tried to warn me in the past." She writes of Bonnie, her best friend, since the age of 14. Bonnie was the friend Sarah went to work with every day after high school, the friend with whom she attended college. She tells about her first hesitant but later outright suspicious feelings toward Bonnie's boyfriend, Tom. She recalls how he ensured that Sarah and Bonnie saw each other less and less often. She recalls becoming estranged from her childhood friend and, ultimately, about hearing the awful news. Bonnie had been stabbed 10 times and set on fire. The person arrested and tried for the murder was, predictably, Bonnie's boyfriend, Tom. "I look at things that I felt then, and they make more sense now." Sarah was extremely upset when the murder conviction was overturned. Sarah's letter was one of many I received from women whose close friends had been killed by husbands or boyfriends. Each had received intuitive signals that didn't make sense at the time, signals they'd been trained a lifetime to ignore. Janet and Melanie listened to their intuition to protect their children, even when others told them their intuition was wrong. Blair and Barbara listened to a clearer signal, fear, and it served them well. But that isn't always the case. I've met a lot of people who weren't served so well by fear. Traveling around the country last year on the press tour for this book, I noticed an interesting pattern. Nearly every journalist I met stopped our formal interview at some point and recounted a personal story about being afraid of someone. One was having trouble with an intimidating and weird neighbor. Another had an ex-boyfriend who wouldn't let go. A few were fearful of co-workers. I became used to hearing the words, "Do you mind if I ask your advice on something?" People called radio shows to ask me questions about danger. Audience members waited to talk to me after television shows, and hundreds of other people wrote asking for advice. Some of their fears were well-founded, some not. But either way, the fear was causing anxiety, and they wanted to talk about it. I could see that the talking itself was doing people some good. Most had been ashamed of their fear and were relieved to see it a new way as part of the human experience. A woman named Andrea Rodriguez wrote to me about hers. "Before reading your book, I had let my imagination and all that I saw on the news get the best of me. I constantly walked around waiting for something to happen. I realize now that when I have my head so filled with what could happen, I'm oblivious to what is happening. For example, as I walk from my car to the grocery store through a dark parking lot, there is a constant buzzing sound in my ears. It's caused by fear of being attacked. Yet, it would probably prevent me from hearing someone if I were approached. By the way, I drive a two-seater for all the right reasons, including that it's fun, and one wrong reason, because before I got it, I used to constantly check and double-check my old car to see if someone was in the back seat. Too many Friday the 13th movies, I guess." I received Andrea's letter right in the middle of one of our country's biggest fear frenzies, the case of multiple murderer Andrew Cunanan, killer of fashion designer Gianni Versace, and several others.
Recall that Cunanan starred in television news stories for weeks. Regular programming was frequently interrupted with the newest piece of frightening speculation. We were told, for example, that every American was at risk as long as Cunanan was on the streets. The fact is that if Andrew Cunanan had kept killing people at the same rate for a decade, it wouldn't have equaled the number of people killed by cigarette smoking in an hour, or the number of children murdered by a parent in a week. In other words, every American was not at risk from Andrew Cunanan. Still, we were warned that he was a chameleon, a master of disguise, but this really amounted to no more than glasses on, glasses off. Because of that media coverage, people all over the country were buying into the paranoia that Andrew Cunanan might appear on their doorstep. This, along with Andrea's letter, made me wonder why Americans worry about such remote risks. It seems that it's because we've got the time. Unlike most people on Earth, we are so secure, so prosperous, so safe, really, that we have the luxury of worrying about things that aren't going to happen. Imagine a mother in Bosnia trying to protect herself and her two children. Has she got time to entertain the fears many Americans obsess over? I don't think so. Let's review a list of what Americans fear, taken from a national poll conducted by Opinion Research Corporation and published in USA Today. It is a virtual index of catastrophes right off the local TV news. For example, 1 in 5 respondents reported the fear of being in an air crash. This isn't surprising, given that whenever a plane falls to Earth, wherever on Earth that happens to happen, we see it on television. As a result, some people driving to an airport might obsess about being in a plane crash. The irony is that they are, at that moment, doing one of the riskiest things Americans ever do, driving without paying attention. Do you suppose the captain of a 747 is ever distracted from piloting by the fear of car accidents? Unlikely, but that concern would be statistically far more valid. 1 in 3 Americans fears being a victim of a violent crime, even though only 1 in 150 actually will be. Fear of people is understandable, though sometimes misplaced. But what about fear of electromagnetic fields? 16% of Americans. Or the fear of food poisoning from meat? 36%? This last fear is as rich in irony as meat is in cholesterol, because uncontaminated or so-called safe meat certainly contributes to more deaths. High cholesterol equals heart attack. What's left to fear? Well, there's being in an unsafe building, 24%, or being exposed to a foreign virus, 30%. I actually met someone with that fear, by the way. A TV news show was doing a special segment on a lethal new disease virtually certain to kill us all before the end of sweeps week. It was a scary-sounding, hard-to-ignore, got-to-see-this-honey-get-in-here made-for-TV disease. As you may have already guessed, it was the flesh-eating disease. Lacking anyone who actually suffered from the malady, the station brought in a woman who was worried she might have it. I was introduced to her in the hallway as she headed toward the studio, and as I watched her interview, it crossed my mind that she could have told me all this before shaking my hand. But no matter, she didn't have it, and I didn't catch it, and neither will you. I've discussed all this fear with several news producers, one of whom assured me that a little worry never hurt anybody. In fact, worry and anxiety hurt plenty of people, through high blood pressure, heart disease, depression, and nervous habits, such as smoking. These things kill hundreds of thousands each year, more by far than all the foreign viruses, electromagnetic fields, and airplane crashes put together. As I watch the way stories are presented on the local news these days, it occurs to me that each evening's broadcast should simply open with, "Welcome to the news. We're surprised you made it through another day." All in all, it's little wonder that the poll showed fully 90% of Americans feel less safe today than they did growing up. But let's look at that safer world of our youth. For most respondents, it was a world without airbags or mandatory seat belts, before the decrease in smoking, before early detection of cancer, before 911 systems showed dispatchers the addresses of people in distress. You remember those carefree 50s before CAT scans, ultrasound, organ transplants, amniocentesis, and coronary bypass surgery. Admittedly, there was no AIDS back then, but there was polio. You remember those oh-so-safe 60s when angry world powers planned nuclear attack and schoolchildren practiced regular air raid drills. This book has explored violence, and clearly the violence we see in the media age is more gruesome than it was in our youth. But that's the point, the violence we see. Years ago, we had a smaller catalog of fears to draw upon. That's because in our satellite age, we don't experience just the calamities in our own lives. We experience the calamities in everyone's lives. And it's no wonder so many people are afraid of so many things. You probably know a person who's acutely worried that some lethal tragedy is about to strike them. There's a way to show that, at core, they don't think any such thing is really going to happen. Here's how. Draw a line on a piece of paper. At the left of the line, write the word birth, and at the end, write the word death. Ask the person to put a mark at the point in their life where they feel they are at today. Try it yourself. As you'll see, almost everybody intersects the line at a place that shows they expect to survive into old age. So we have a lot of time left. Do we want to spend it worrying? We can't always control what might happen to us, of course, but we can control what we focus on. Andrea Rodriguez reminded me of this in a letter when she wrote about how this book affected her. I'm not saying I'll be walking blindly down dark alleys, depending solely on my intuition to save me, but I am going to make a conscious effort to clear my mind of those relentless thoughts of what could happen. Thank you, Andrea. I am very grateful to hear that this book helped you and others be safer and less afraid. You aren't reckless, but at the same time, you aren't worrying. You know that fear will come and get your attention if necessary, and otherwise, it will leave you alone. Gavin De Becker, May 1998.
The End. You've been listening to The Gift of Fear by Gavin De Becker, narrated by Tom Stecschulte. The author includes several appendices containing additional information and sources for help and advice. We include them here, again narrated by Tom Stecschulte.
Appendix. Help-giving resources. National Domestic Violence Hotline. 1-800-799-SAFE. This hotline provides information, support, and referral to battered women's shelters in your area. Impact. Full contact self-defense training for women using padded instructors who pose as assailants. Courses teach verbal skills to avoid confrontation, ways to make victimization less likely, and techniques designed specifically for the physical advantages women bring to self-defense. Available in most major American cities. For additional information, call Impact at 1-800-345-5425. Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America. Call 215-567-7000 for a number in your area and details on how these exceptional mentoring programs work. Al-Anon Family Groups. Help families affected by alcoholism and addiction. Special groups for children and teens are available in most areas. Al-Anon is reached through directory assistance or through a local office of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or call 1-800-344-2666. In Canada, 1-800-443-4525. Internet web page, www.alanon.alateen.org. National Victim Center, InfoLink Program. Call 1-800-FYI-CALL. For comprehensive information and referrals to more than 8,000 victim assistance programs across the nation. Each caller can receive up to 5 of the 70 information bulletins free of charge. All InfoLink bulletins are available on the Internet at www.nvc.org. Civitas Initiative, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to discover and broadly communicate real-world solutions to problems impeding the optimal development of children. Civitas partners with public and private institutions to support innovations in any area and will have a systematic impact on the health and welfare of maltreated children. If you are interested in investing in the healthy development of children, please call or write Civitas Initiative, 16 East Pearson, Chicago, Illinois, 60611. Area code 312-226-6700. www.bcm.tmc.edu/civitas. PACS, a nonprofit organization dedicated to reducing gun violence in America. PACS promotes social awareness, personal responsibility, and common sense regulation as solutions to the gun violence crisis. In addition, PACS provides organizational resources for individuals and groups involved in the movement against gun violence. There is no cost for services or membership. www.paxweb.org or 212-677-1124. Victory Over Violence. The Official Advisory Board to the Domestic Violence Council, an organization of people from the entertainment industry, business, and government dedicated to increasing public awareness and providing direct support to families fleeing from domestic violence. Among its many projects, VOV funds nursing care for women and children at shelters, provides art therapy for children, coordinates cosmetic surgery programs for women disfigured by domestic violence injuries, and provides children's play areas at district attorney's offices so women can give crime reports without being overheard by their young children. We welcome your help, financial and otherwise. Gun safety. For some people, banning handguns is the psychological equivalent of government-imposed castration. So let me be clear. I'm not challenging our so-called right to bear arms, in whose name, by the way, more Americans have died at home than have died at war. And I'm not advocating gun control. I am advocating something far more practical, something we might call bullet control. I propose that we hold gun manufacturers to the same product liability standards we require for every other consumer product. Imagine if caustic drain opener were sold in easy-pour, flip-top, pistol-grip dispensers made attractive to children by the endorsement of celebrities. Now, drain openers can hurt people, but they aren't made for that purpose. Handguns are made precisely for that purpose. So shouldn't manufacturers be required to build in safety features that have been technologically practical for decades? Even electric drills have safety triggers, yet revolvers do not. Guns could have components that inhibit firing by children, or technologies that allow operation only in the hands of the owner, with a coded ring or wristband, for example, or a combination lock built into the gun. In the meantime, it's easier to shoot most handguns than it is to open a bottle of children's vitamins. Speaking of tamper-proof containers, the design of billions of bottles of consumer products was changed after the deaths of 8 people from poisoned Tylenol, a tragedy completely beyond the control of the manufacturer, while gun makers knowingly and enthusiastically produce products that kill 500 Americans each week. And we don't require a single safety feature. Does it make sense to you that manufacturers who sell products specifically designed to inflict tissue damage, to do it efficiently, rapidly, portably, and lethally, have fewer safety requirements than virtually every other product you use? Gun companies will say their buyers understand and accept the risks of firearms, but that doesn't answer for the 40 New Yorkers killed by stray bullets in 1 year alone, or for all the other people who will become unwilling consumers of ammunition. To be certain the gun manufacturers have no misunderstanding, let me do right now what I hope more Americans will do, which is to put them on notice. I, for one,
do not accept the avoidable risks posed by your products. As a potential victim, I do not sign on to any implied agreement with Colt or Smith & Wesson or Ruger. And I hold you entirely accountable for your failure to build in child-safe and other locking features that would clearly and predictably reduce deaths. Some gun owners explain that they needn't lock their weapons because they don't have children. Well, other people do have children, and they will visit your home one day. The plumber who answers your weekend emergency will bring along his bored 9-year-old son, and he will find your gun. The other oft-quoted reason for not locking guns is that they must be ready to fire immediately in an emergency, perhaps in the middle of the night. Imagine being in your deepest sleep and then a split second later finding yourself driving a truck as it careens down a dark highway at 70 miles per hour. That's the condition gun advocates vigorously insist remain available to them, the ability to sit up in bed and start firing bullets into the dark without pausing to operate a safety lock. An Associated Press story described one gun owner who didn't even have to sit up in bed. She just reached under her pillow, took her .38 in hand, and, thinking it was her asthma medicine, shot herself in the face. Every year in California alone, close to 100,000 guns are stolen. The people of my state more than make up for the loss by purchasing 650,000 guns each year. Little wonder that in a typical week, almost 1,000 Californians are shot. The majority survive to tell about their ordeal, so that those who hear the awful tales can rush out and buy guns. There's a lot to think about here, but my main point is that those stolen guns would be worthless and harmless if a locking system made them inoperable. In the meantime, if you own a gun, you can do something the manufacturers have neglected to do. Lock it. Not just the cabinet or the closet or the drawer, but the gun itself. This paragraph is a survival signal for some child, because that is who will likely find the gun that the owner felt certain was too high to reach or too hard to fire. Gun locks are available at gun stores and many sporting goods stores. Though not marketed specifically for guns, many types of padlocks can be placed through the trigger guard behind the trigger of revolvers. One excellent one for this purpose is the Sesame Lock, manufactured by Corbin, which is available at many hardware stores. An advantage of this lock is that if a gun is found by an intruder and aimed at you, the lock is clearly visible to you on the gun. The Corbin Sesame Lock also allows the buyer to program in his or her own combination, making rapid removal easy if one knows the combination. Workplace violence. Understanding and preventing workplace violence is a series of videotapes that provide advanced training for managers of government agencies, large corporations, and universities. The program includes interviews with perpetrators and victims of major acts of violence in the workplace. Co-written by Park Dietz and Gavin DeBecker, both of whom are extensively interviewed, it received the Mercury Video Awards Gold Medal for Best Training Tape and was rated by the Employee Assistance Association of America at 100 out of 100 points. Narrated by Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and produced by Emmy-nominated filmmaker Gregory Orr, the program covers such topics as predicting violent behavior, the warning signs of workplace violence, the legal issues, pre-employment screening, and the termination process. Topics were guided by an advisory board of representatives from Kraft Foods, the Walt Disney Company, the United States Marshals Service, Pfizer, and Target Stores. The 8-part 4-hour series can be purchased by calling 1-800-993-6330 or through Video Distribution, 3727 West Magnolia Boulevard, Suite 162, Burbank, California, 91510-7711. Questions for your child's school. Do you have a policy manual or teacher's handbook? May I have a copy or review it here? Is the safety of students the first item addressed in the policy or handbook? If not, why not? Is the safety of students addressed at all?
Are there policies addressing violence, weapons, drug use, sexual abuse, child-on-child sexual abuse, unauthorized visitors? Are background investigations performed on all staff? What areas are reviewed during these background inquiries? Who gathers the information? Who in administration reviews the information and determines the suitability for employment? What are the criteria for disqualifying an applicant? Does the screening process apply to all employees, teachers, janitors, lunchroom staff, security personnel, part-time employees, etc.? Is there a nurse on site at all times while children are present, including before and after school? What is the nurse's education or training? Can my child call me at any time? May I visit my child at any time? What is your criteria for when to contact parents? What are the parent notification procedures? What are the student pickup procedures? How is it determined that someone other than me can pick up my child? How does the school address special situations, custody disputes, child kidnapping concerns, etc.? Are older children separated from younger children during recess, lunch, restroom breaks, etc.? Are acts of violence or criminality at the school documented? Are statistics maintained? May I review the statistics? What violence or criminality has occurred at the school during the last 3 years? Is there a regular briefing of teachers and administrators to discuss safety and security issues? Are teachers formally notified when a child with a history of serious misconduct is introduced to their class? What is the student-to-teacher ratio in class, during recess, during meals? How are students supervised during visits to the restroom? Will I be informed of teacher misconduct that might have an impact on the safety or well-being of my child? Are there security personnel on the premises? Are security personnel provided with written policies and guidelines? Is student safety the first issue addressed in the security policies and guidelines material? If not, why not? Is there a special background investigation conducted on security personnel, and what does it encompass? Is there any control over who can enter the grounds? If there is an emergency in a classroom, how does the teacher summon help? If there is an emergency on the playground, how does the teacher summon help? What are the policies and procedures covering emergencies, fire, civil unrest, earthquake, violent intruder, etc.? How often are emergency drills performed? What procedures are followed when a child is injured? What hospital would my child be transported to in the event of a serious injury? Can I designate a different hospital, a specific family doctor? What police station responds to the school? Who is the school's liaison at the police department? The school should have a ready answer to every one of these questions. Just the process of asking these questions, which can be done in writing, will identify those areas that have not been considered or thoroughly addressed by the school's officials.
Gavin De Becker Incorporated provides advanced training on the assessment of threats, case management, and the prediction of violent behavior to police departments, prosecutors, state and federal agencies, large corporations, and universities. 1, 2, and 3-day courses are taught at Boulder Creek, the firm's 18-acre training facility just outside Los Angeles. You can reach Gavin De Becker Incorporated by mail at 11684 Ventura Boulevard, Suite 440, Studio City, California, 91604, or by fax at 818-506-0426. Additional sources regarding high-stakes predictions involving stalkers, angry employees, or abusive spouses can be obtained through the Gavin De Becker Incorporated webpage at www.gdbinc.com or by calling 1-800-993-6330.
Context of white supremacy. All done. Gavin De Becker, The Gift of Fear. What a list of questions for the school. I hope if we have any Parents listening, if you do, unfortunately, have your children in the public school system, wow, that was a great list of questions, regardless of, you know, how constructive you thought the book was. Oh, always love great questions to ask at school. What is your policy on how you monitor the children when they go to the bathroom? What a great question, and particularly Jeffrey Epstein and all the rest of it. That is phenomenal. Put that one in for tomorrow. Parents, cha-ching. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If we didn't get to hear from you at all and you have a comment, question you would like to share as we wrap up The Gift of Fear, make sure you get a hand up. Do not wait until the last few moments of the broadcast. *61 if you have comments, questions. Let's see. We'll nab some of the folks we missed first time around. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Let's see. Ivy, Mr. Demery 4, Red in Nevada, Thomas in New York. I'll look out for other hands as I see folks on the switchboard. Any final thoughts, what we heard from the epilogue? Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Ivy.
This is Red in Nevada. I definitely appreciate all the questions. I think that was one of the more, I know somebody said something about solutions. I know it doesn't necessarily give a solution, but it might at least help, you know, provide the tool to finding out whether the school or whatever is right for your child or not. So I thought that was good. And then also, actually, I thought that it was interesting. He keeps, every time he brings up an example of some type of violent act, I always think of, like, the first type of people who come to mind are white people. And if I'm not mistaken, I know somebody else said something about contradictions, but I thought somewhere in the book he said something about violence not being studied or something like that, or maybe I'm mixing up books or whatever, but it seems like you really don't need to have intuition. It's simply because, you know, all you have to do is, you know, with white women, all they have to do is just simply look around in their own community and they can see the violence. They just choose, because of, you know, upholding white supremacy, they just choose to ignore it. And with the gun, with his suggestions about the locks and stuff like that, I guess that would be another example of why this book is, at least to me, more for white women rather than for anybody else, especially why it may even be a book that white men don't like. Like, it seems like with white men, whenever you start speaking about putting stricter protections or whatever on guns, that's when they're staunch opponents of it. So I thought that was interesting, because before we started reading the book, I really didn't know anything about Gavin DeBecker. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's the reason why he's, I don't know, maybe it was just because of the time when the book came out or whatever, but it just made me think about the whole gun fight thing that I guess is going on right now. And I mean, my line. Thank you.
Very similar to some of the discussions they're having right now and that they have every time. Often it is a white killer, then a few exceptions. But mostly when these white killers go on their rampages, shooting and killing. Other folks who dialed in, if you have concluding thoughts, questions, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Yes, I thought the questions were constructive. I would say primarily he was thinking on the behalf of white people in general, as far as the questions to ask. Being that he is I would think is a typical white male who is that I would suspect of being a racist, that he would be primarily talking about white people in general as far as questions are asked, but it is something that everybody that has a child can benefit from, irregardless. So, yeah.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Absolutely. I think anybody, if you're around children, you work with children, those are great questions to check over, especially some of the ones that focus on safety and having that be a number one objective with dealing with children. That's bravo. Other folks dialed in, if you have comments, questions, as we conclude The Gift of Fear, feel free.
Ivy here.
That is Ivy. Messed up the first time. Greetings.
Greetings, Gus. And shout out to our resident expert as well and all the callers on the line. I thought that this portion was, I thought it was very constructive, and I'm going to get to it, but I want to go back to some things that I said earlier. I wanted to point out, because I don't think I did before, that when I said about how males are victims like far more than women are, that was also true. Like, you can go as far back in terms of looking at statistics. You can go as far back at least from what I saw as 95. So the same thing is like was true around the time that this book was published. So I don't know, what he's talking about there. I actually had a question because I don't remember. Gus, do you know if this book addresses psychological abuse in terms of violence, or is he just talking about physical violence?
I think it's mostly physical violence. Like, he might have had a mention here or there about, being abusive with language, but most of this is about physical violence. I know the workplace stuff. Yeah, I don't remember the workplace stuff dealing with people just being verbally abusive, and most of the couples type or domestic situations, I'll say it that way, they seem to deal with physical violence.
Oh, okay. But yeah, in terms of the men being victims more so than women, like way more, there's too much emphasis, I think, in general about like female victimhood, and if things were more balanced, I think it would go a long way in terms of reducing a lot of the victimization that men suffer by each other, and of course by women as well. So I think that's very important. And then I believe earlier, like some weeks back, I was hearing that this is like he has a feminism perspective, and that's why, or a feminist perspective, and that's why he's approaching this book the way that he is. Let me see how I can put this. I wonder if that's a part of just the propaganda of feminism, because the whole point, just as we pointed out many times over the course of this broadcast and just like the whole program itself, feminism was brought out to distract from racism. And it was brought out to deflect from it, which, of course, you know, it's just this there's a lot of, like, propaganda regarding feminism and a whole lot of lies, a whole lot of exaggeration of female victimization and things of that nature to distract from what Black people suffer. And there isn't a group on the planet who is a victim of violence more than Black people. And I really appreciated the commentary throughout the course of this book study from a lot of you all who pointed that out, that, you know, that's not addressed at all, and how he just he talks around racism, but he doesn't speak to it directly. And just the importance of bringing out how Black people suffer from being victims of violence, mostly by white people, just from being victims of racism in general. And I also wanted to stress that, you know, even though I said what I said earlier regarding intuition, I think intuition certainly has a place, but not where you substitute it for logic at all. I also thought when he brought out the details of Oprah endorsing his book and the just the reaction that he's gotten from this book and the positive reaction to things of that nature, to me it just came across as bragging and boastful. I thought he was real prideful about all that. I thought that he was real egotistical about it. And I found it interesting. A contradiction that I found is that when certain things are rare, like plane crashes and things of that nature, he really points that out and really talks about how we really shouldn't exaggerate when it comes to things like that, and we really shouldn't worry too much about things like that. And the white people in the news, they tend to exaggerate those types of things to get us so fearful and things of that nature. And yet you have these small numbers, even smaller than the small numbers that he pointed out in other areas. You have these small numbers with regard to guns and gun violence and things of that nature and violence regarding that. And yet he played that up so much, and he played it up as though, like, you get shot, like, more than you die from heart disease or something like that. I just thought that that was really a contradiction. Like, are we going to have some balance in the way that we think about things that are rare, or are we going to, you know, worry a whole lot about them? And I'm not saying that, you know, gun locks or things of that nature are not good things or whatever the case may be, but I just thought that that was a contradiction, the way that he, you know, really played up guns as if people suffer from, I guess, violence at the hands of guns or people with guns much more than they do. And also the last thing that I wanted to say is, I wonder what the reaction would be, like, in terms of all of those questions about at school and, you know, how do you a lot of the questions that he had regarding school and how things are conducted there. If a Black parent asked all those questions, I really wonder what the reaction would be. It would be very, very interesting. I wonder if their child would be expelled from school, or if they would just, if that would be one of the children that they wouldn't mess with all that much, or if at all, because they might be afraid, or who knows. But yeah, I think that would be very interesting. I'm sure there are, you know, Black parents out there that, you know, ask all those questions. I wonder what type of response they get. That was it. I'm in my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Absolutely. I don't know how well they tolerate questioning niggers. They don't even tolerate questioning Black children at school, much less, you know, questioning Black parents. Anybody else that we missed who had questions, comments, observations they wanted to make sure they get in as we conclude Gavin De Becker, The Gift of Fear?
and I'll share a few and then double check if folks have other thoughts. It was odd because I was going through, and this is not in the book. The book, the appendix is in the book, but the part where he was talking about Oprah and the letters and stuff that he got, that is not in the book. So I was going to highlight, and there was nothing to highlight. The tamper-proof guns, that all of that is so tired and trite, I generally don't even listen to it now when whites begin talking about all of that. They had a segment, this was some years back, President Obama was still in the White House, but they had a segment, and they had a white man, it was, you know, some shooting, and they said, hey, we could do that. This book was written in 97, so I mean, the tamper technology now, like, they could have all kinds of stuff. They could have, you know, it'd be some sort of bio lock, you know, where it would register your fingerprint or retina scan or any kind of thing. And they had some of these. They were showing prototypes of these types of guns. They had the ring one that he talked about. They had lots of different ones. They said, oh, no, absolutely not. Going to have a very hard time giving this to kick off, because they said the fear, they got it again, the fear, and there was all white people that they presented that were fearful about this. I don't recall there being one black person, one non-white person who was fearful about this. But the fear was that if they made these sort of guns, like regular widespread availability, that would become the standard. It would be, all right, no more of the regulars. All the firearms that are going to be sold have to have these tamper-proof ones. And they go back to the same argument. Oh, no, you're going to take our guns. No way. Then all the ones that we have that don't have that, you're going to come around to do some sort of confiscation program from my cold, dead hand. So that has stopped. That's why in 20 years they've made no progress with those tamper-resistant, child-proof gun locks. I think it was like 60 Minutes or one of the other mainstream outlets. Pick whatever shooting you want to insert that happened in the last 5 years, but they gave a detailed explanation as to why that has made no traction and probably will make no traction. And again, in my view, that goes right back. The grandsister, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, when he had the segment where he said that some compare it to taking guns away to castration. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, the great equalizer, and that's not some people, that's not males in general, that is white men, and that's pretty widely acknowledged without dispute. That is white men who make that sort of equation. All of this goes back to what is not mentioned in the book at all, the system of racism, white supremacy. Why do we need all these firearms in the first place? Why are we so resistant to having gun control so we don't have these shootings every other week, like he was talking about in 1997, we've been talking about for the last 25, 50 years. System of white supremacy. What are we most fearful about? O.J. Simpson is going to get another one of our white women. Might have to shoot Al Sharpton. O.J. Simpson, any one of these niggers, might have to shoot him. Never know. He also mentioned several of those I guess these were the ones right at the beginning where they had the incident with the mom and her son, this white man taking all this interest and showing pornography to her son. Sounds like he might have been Jerry Sandusky trying to rape this young boy. I think they had the other one about the white male who was in the Marines. And then he came and started staying with his girlfriend, staying in the house, and they did not eject him immediately. And then he ended up killing one of the white women. In those situations, using logic. I think he gave some of the examples that he gave about asking questions, especially if it's going to be someone who's taking care of your child, asking questions to potentially eliminate this person and having a lot of suspicion and or skepticism, and then using logic to evaluate closely, scrutinize anything about this person if they're going to be spending time with your child. With the previous one, not the child one, but the one where the Marine white dude, I was having a white guy staying there with these white women in college or what have you, and ends up killing one of them. I think they said looking at a person's past behavior, I cannot emphasize that enough, especially if we're talking about some sort of spousal abuse situation. Past behavior as a huge indicator. The person can say, white people do that. They can say whatever they want to. Look at their past behavior. Look at their pattern of behavior. This is the type of thing that you're involved in. In fact, that should be on the 200 list of questions.
Have you ever engaged in any sort of domestic abuse? Has that ever been a problem? And you can ask several questions maybe about that and see what the person says. And then you make sure from there, first time, last time. Any other questions, comments folks want to make sure they get in before we conclude Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear? He is definitely within all of this about promoting his industry. I totally agree with the narcissism as well. I felt that immediately when he began talking and the letters, just all of it. That, you know, I was right and my book has been so powerful and touched so many people's lives, and I'm so smart, such an expert. Oprah Winfrey thinks that I'm so great and had me back on. Like, I got that exact feeling. And again, that's why I say it's so startling, because that's what I'm accustomed to with whites, them bragging and showing, you know, a bounty of confidence about their expertise on all things, especially whatever their, you know, field of interest is. Anywho, we should be here next week. New book should be the late, great Toni Morrison, Tar Baby. I still, you know, if folks have, they really want to read one of the shooter's manifestos, because that was suggested. I think that could be constructive, but since she just passed away and had such an enormous body of constructive counter-racist work, I think this one is on our favorite subject, Area 8, Tar Baby. I think it would be a great one to read, and so enjoy Bluest Eye. That was right up there, I think, with Medical Apartheid and Warmth of Other Suns, one of the books that I really enjoyed reading with the book club. So hopefully can do it again starting next week. Toni Morrison, Tar Baby. That should be a really easy book if you want a hard copy to read along, especially now. Should be, well, maybe I guess if you can get a copy at the library, might be checked out, but you have a little time to get your hands on a copy if you would like. We will be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We will check in if folks have strategies, tips. We're looking forward tomorrow. Still waiting to update our code for folks who are pregnant in the workplace, so that we can add to things to do, things not to do, things to say, things not to say, resume tips included. That said, final check. Everybody satisfied? Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear? Awesome. First time, last time. I've said that so much this week. First time, last time. That is supposed to be said before any licks happen.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, Thomas in New York. Just, I'll repeat it again. Time, you're good. No apologies. The first time, last time, that should be said before any licks happen. Hopefully there'll be no licks, period, but that should be said very early on so that that's understood how we're supposed to conduct ourselves. First time, last time, no hitting. Gets to that point. Well, it's been nice. I wish you the best. And we will, you know, call it a arrangement or relationship or whatever. And I will bid you adieu. Thomas in New York.
Yes. So did he ever define the word fear inside of the text?
For the word fear, I would have to check back through to see if he gave a definition. I remember intuition. He definitely gave a definition. Did he give a definition for fear? I know he gave a definition, which I thought was important, the difference between wait a minute. I think he did, because it was with worry. I think it's in chapter 15, because he gave a lot of time talking about the difference between worries and anxieties, that these are in the mind, that they're not really rooted in something that can actually cause you harm, that this is your imagination. I'd have to go back through to get his definition exactly, but I suspect it's in chapter 15 here.
Okay, because I only use the words in there, I only try to use the 1828 Webster dictionary, because it's the first one that holds up in court. And it's sort of like the first Bronze Accordion because it also breaks down you know, some of the biblical stuff. But it says a painful emotion or passion excited by the expectation of evil or apprehension of impending danger. Fear expresses less apprehension than dread, and dread less than terror and fright. The force of this passion, beginning with the most moderate degree, must be expressed. Fear, then dread, terror, then fright. Fear is accomplished by the desire to avoid or ward off an expected evil. Fear is an uneasiness of the mind upon thought of the future evil likely of before us. What really struck me out was the fifth definition they have here, and it made me think strange fruit. Something set or hung up to terrify wild animals by color or noise. By color or noise. It just made me think they used to hang us. And the seventh definition is the worship of God. It's also considered fear. And I got me thinking, like, that's a huge part of the religion of white supremacy, is that you must fear God. You know, you have to be afraid of him. That was it, because the book was called Gift of Fear, and I didn't recall a definition for it. I think it's a great book.
Much obliged. I think consistently the way it's explained, I'd have to go through to highlight a specific sentence where he says fear is, but the way that he consistently talks about it from what I'm reading, right, well, when it is real fear, it will either be in the presence of danger or it will link to pain or death. So I think that at least matches the portion of the definition where it's supposed to be, the way that he talks in the book, it is supposed to be linked to something that is actual, not something that you're thinking about, could happen, might happen. This is a hypothetical situation. It is supposed to be, oh my goodness, I'm on a cliff and I actually could fall. That this is, the cliff is right here. Gravity is operating. I could slip and fall. It should be linked to something that is actual, that could cause pain, death, harm in some way, shape, form, not something that's made up that might, could hypothetically happen. I'll flip back through, but I think that's generally the way that he describes fear in the text. With that, we did our broadcast. We completed the book, hopefully. Hopefully folks got some tips that they can use in a variety of different areas, even maybe the workplace racism one. I will be using that one and have encouraged it several times, both about planning mooring. I thought that was a great one. And the suggestion about paying attention to signs, potential problems in the workplace. People talking about firearms, guns, making jokes about shootings and things. All of that right in the book. You can bring that up. Hey, this is not appropriate or professional for a safe work environment. Use that word, safe. Tar Baby for next week. Much obliged for everyone who participated live and or archived. Again, reading is more important than watching television. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, since we are in an environment that is saturated with white terrorism and violence, especially aimed at black people. Always a great idea to have your brain computer working at maximum efficiency so that you can use logic to process any potential dangers and what you might need to do in your situation to keep yourself safe. As safe as possible, anyway. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Please stay off your cell phone if you are behind the wheel. Victims of racism, we do not need to do anything to draw unnecessary attention to us in a system of white terrorism. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately.
Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.